So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
Stay.
Again, Tony, say it
again. I want to be able to show you a sample of my black magic. I have waited, stay for this moment. Come. I will take you. Stay. Stay. Try to defeat the Black Scorpion. The Black Scorpion's black magic will be too much, too powerful for you. Sting, I have come to defeat you. Sting, I am here.
My God, I can't believe what we have seen here. The Black Scorpion appeared, Paul, and he disappeared and he reappeared. Where is he?
That ain't right. What's going on here? That ain't right. Things like that aren't supposed to happen. You can't be in two places at once.
Fans here are as bewildered as we are. The Black Scorpion appeared.
Disappeared, and what happened?
Where was he in that cage there? He was somewhere in the cage. Where did he go?
He wasn't in the cage afterwards. And he disappeared, and he had a girl. He took a girl out of the crowd, and he disappeared. What happened?
Welcome to a special edition of Review Away. It is John Pollock, and Waiting is off. He has just traveled to a faraway distance, and here, in his chair, keeping it warm, he is the one and only. SureDog.com's Jordan Breen returning by popular demand, Jordan. There have been requests, there have been demands, and we have met those requests and demands this week with a review that I'm sure will be a fun one.
So last time, I think you could characterize my first Review Away appearance as constituently hung on an absolutely abysmal pro wrestling card. And mostly, I just freaked out about how terrible the Sid Knight Stalker match was while alternately saying, dude, fuck. So, not my finest performance. I'm losing my voice.
Many people disagree with that assessment. Maybe we'll love that show.
I liked it already in my second appearance, after you teased that we were going to get into some Halloween Havoc 1990. Someone like me asked me, why do you choose shitty WCW shows from this era? Why do you do this? Why can't you do a WWE show from another time? And I'm a terrible guy. I'm here to torture your listenership, and I'm telling you right now, I've already told John, because when you do this show, it's stressful, because when you hand me the reins and say, pick a subject. Like, I'm excited, but I'm overwhelmed with choice. But at the same time, you guys have been doing this so long, so successfully, that you've already crossed off a lot of, you know, like, I wasn't here for Heroes of Wrestling, and that shatters me as a man. So I got to try to, you know, pick and choose my spots, go through this long laundry list. Also, shout-outs to your listeners, by the way, who maintain the chronological order of all review-aways, as well as the sequential order of review-aways.
There are some machines on the message board.
Yeah,
archivist, Brad, I mean, my goodness.
These homies you got in the Army, they're a vicious and beautiful group. But, it's hard when you go through. So I was excited. I was thinking of, like, weird events that'd be good for, and I thought, oh, my God, they've never done Spin the Wheel, Make the Deal. 1992 yep. Halloween Havoc. But then you just mentioned with last week, you guys did the Bischoff DVD. Very nice stuff, by the way.
Trying to mix the current with the nostalgia.
Yeah, so I mean, going back to the era that kind of like sets up why Eric Bischoff ends up being in charge of this in a cascading effect. Old Pizza Hut Jim Herd.
Well, if we were ever to come out with another Review Away t-shirt, I mean, is there a better epitome of it than Jim Herd? I mean, that time period from his installment right through until the blow-ups with Ric Flair, and then finally getting ousted, and then the successors after Jim Herd. I mean, what a figure that I would love to sit down and chat with that man. I think he appeared on Dave Meltzer's Yada show once.
Oh, wow.
And outside of that, I don't know how many... I mean, he was at least talking at this point to various media at the time. But since that time, going back to hear from Jim Herd...
Did he just go back to Pizza Hut? Like, what realm of you know, management did he get into after this?
I don't even know where he went after this, to be quite honest with you.
Can we Wikipedia this? Am I automatically connected to internet? Oh, that's amazing. I think I am. So let's look at
that, how it remembers your last time here.
That's what I mean. That actually kind of frightens me a little bit.
Because we should, as Jordan looks up the career trajectory of Jim Herd, our last review was the Clash of Champions that followed this pay-per-view. So we're in the same era, just going back, because it was November 90.
Yeah, like we're just rewinding a few weeks, basically. It's not even, and to the point I made where a few people already complained on Twitter, like, oh, dude, you came on for a second time and you basically chose the same show. Yeah, we really just rewound it a few weeks. But what's dramatic, and we'll get to kind of right off the top when we dive into the event, You see how tumultuous, calamitous, and truly batshit this era is. Because think about this. The first match we're going to talk about, because the network.
Yeah.
The network with the 2-hour clip down version. I know that, like, during this time, you know, Turner would, like, they're famous for the super pared down VHSs.
Yes.
So, like, that's obviously this version.
Collector's nightmare.
If you're out there for future reference, if you're out there and you're a fan, I know how hardcore the fans are here. If you got some kind of way to always make sure they got the original pay-per-view rip or something like that, make sure it's always available for review away. Because I would have loved to have gone through the
Master Blasters. We tried to track down the Masters here. And
yeah.
As soon as I informed Jordan that, hey, man, it's the 2-hour edited version that's on the network, and I could not find this full show anywhere. I mean, there was really one name that came to mind. Like, if this thing exists anywhere in an attic in the middle of nowhere, Ohio.
Oh, yeah.
David Bixenspan would be aware of it, and we reached out to him, and unfortunately, it was not something where we could simply acquire this within a day or two to review, but to their credit...
Shout-outs to 605 Super Podcast Show. It's Between the Sheets. Shouts Bix.
One thing to note, though, on this particular edited version, I mean, sometimes they were hit and miss with what they would edit, but they largely kept the strength and some of the weaknesses to best encapsulate Halloween Havoc in a 2-hour form.
So here's what we're missing.
Yes.
Here's what, unfortunately... the folks at the UIC Pavilion, October 27th, 1990, got to enjoy, but we will not be talking about because the WWE Network just dropping the ball.
That $2.5 million, that included the library. I mean, you should be getting everything.
Tim Horner pins Barry Horowitz in 8 minutes and 35 seconds and then steals Jim Cornette's ring truck money. Rip Rogers defeats Reno Riggins, goes over in about 4 minutes, 3:57 to be exact. And then in between the meat of the card we're talking about, Terry Taylor going 12 minutes with old Wild Bill Irwin, getting himself a pinfall. Brad Armstrong goes over J.W. Storm, Mr. Jeff Warner in 5 minutes. What I'm really sad about, because they actually play a role, and I think an amusing, charming role, in something that we will talk about with the Midnight Smash, the Southern Boys.
The Southern Boys. Future the young Pistols.
On it like a duck on a June bug? Is that what Tracy's mother said on The Clash of the Champions?
Yes,
that killed you?
They were much better featured on The Clash than they were in VHS form coming out of the Halloween Havoc.
Well, Al Green and Mr. Kevin Nash, the Master Blasters, go over the Southern Boys on this card and defeat them in 7 minutes, 17 seconds, but...
Poor Kevin Nash, no royalty money in 1990.
I wonder how hard Nash worked in that match. That's the kind of reason that you want to see, like, a match like that. I want to see, like, you know, is Nash even in 1990 thinking, like, I'm not making the VHS.
200,000 pies.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, no one's going to see this. What am I going to do? I'm not bumping for that.
We almost need a term for these matches because they're not dark matches.
No.
There's something in between.
Yeah, they're just left on the cutting room floor. Just the sad bastard matches that got left behind by the network cut. Also, in a little canine related action, JYD goes over Moondog Rex.
Yes, which was quite the fall after he had been brought back in 1990 because Flair was out of opponents and they thought, hey, let's bring back JYD, all 237 pounds of him, and it resulted in some awful matches with Ric Flair. And that was only in May they brought him back, and here we are in October, and this was the plight of one JYD.
Yeah, so going back to what I was just talking about, like this tumultuous era. Oh, and one other bit of house cleaning. Like I was saying, in future, when I return, if there's future popular demand, I mean, I hope there is.
Jordan, I think we have a good relationship here. I do Press Row, you do Review Away.
But you guys got like a different kind of audience, you know what I mean? They're serious about this, and I think, you know, it could disappoint some people if I'm just going and choosing Jim Herd era stuff all the time, but that's my jam. And rest assured, 91 Havoc's been done already, so next time I'm here, probably going to be spinning the wheel, make the deal.
Well, there you go, get
which
ready.
Which is...
1992.
I'm going to do Halloween Havoc 92. I'll have the coal miner's glove on for the entire...
Oh, that'd have to be a video one, of course.
Oh, yeah,
with some props.
We'll do it.
We'll have a wheel, maybe. Maybe our own Review Away, spin the wheel.
Oh, shit.
I do want to have the three of us with Way, because... The last one, it's only been you and I, correct?
Yeah.
The last one, Wei wasn't with us,
no.
Was he?
No, it was the same situation. Wei was coming back.
I worry for him because I look at these when we do three-person shows, when we have Damien come in, first of all, it's always great because you're local. We've tried Skype reviews before. Those are very tough. Just having people in person is good.
What you don't know is I moved all the way from Halifax, Nova Scotia, uprooted.
For this podcast.
Yeah, just for these opportunities, man.
But you and I think, can lend ourselves to become power talkers. And Wei is not a self-professed power talker. So I worry for him.
Wei's a great counterpuncher, though.
That's true.
And it's also, too, because, you know, if you don't know, like, Wei Tang personally, I'm always impressed listening to the podcast and watching TV. Wei is, he's not the most fired up panda in the forest. You know what I mean? He's a very, like, taciturn, chill dude in person. And I'm always surprised how he, like, punches it up. For the broadcast.
He's the cool factor that I do not bring to this podcast.
He's a dude that really goes beyond himself in a way that always impresses me. Because, like you said, like he's not like that natural talker. But, like, well, this man's murderous in the radio and TV game now. Just really punches it up.
You know, the way we plotted this, I mean, this was mainly to give Wei a bit of a break because he was off in Ottawa working all weekend. As were you. Yep. You two could have just hooked up and done this review in a hotel room. It could have been me cut out.
That's what I mean. Like, Wei's...
I want to hear a Jordan Wei review, personally. I think that'd be a lot of fun.
I'd love it.
So we're going to get into this period. This was just
Hang on. Speaking of power talking, because we're side branching so hard, the last thing I want to say is I was saying that, like, this, like, right off the top, speaking of the fact that this is only a few weeks before that terrible Clash of the Champions, because this is October 27th, Clash of the Champions, it's over Thanksgiving, so it's like 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, whatever.
Yep.
The fact that in that short period of time, we're going to say goodbye to some people.
Oh, there were some big departures after this show.
Immediately yes. After the show. Cornett and Stan Lane, this is their last WCW appearance.
Ole Anderson, shortly fired after this. Mm-hmm. This was his last pay-per-view booking. Mm-hmm. And that would eventually open the doors for Dusty Rhodes to return in...
Is this his last pay-per-view booking? So who would have done the Scorpion voice at...
That was where the committee was just installed afterwards. And they had no idea of where to go. And it ended up being Ric Flair that got to become the Black Scorpion, though he did not play it on this particular night.
Al Perez
was one of many.
Well, here's the thing. Al Perez was the guy. He played on most of the house shows. He went over Brian Pillman, as we talked about when I said on the last show that there was a guy on this card who's
just think, folks, that you went to a WCW house show circa 1990, the fall of 1990, and you may have been watching Sting versus Al Perez headline.
Also, Al Perez ends up not being the Black Scorpion. Because he doesn't want a job to Sting. Al Perez. He's an actual jobber, dude. He's an actual jobber. And he gets this dumb gimmick. This is the blessing of a lifetime. You know, this is a preposterous gimmick. But this is, you know, you gotta, like the dude who played the boogeyman.
Marty Wright.
Yeah, he's not going to be remembered finally by pro wrestling fans. But he got a weird opportunity and milked the teat for all the money he could. That's part of the game. This is a carny thing, right?
Sure.
This is a sideshow. Get the money where you can.
The show, which featured 8,000 people at the beautiful UIC Pavilion, did a $115,000 gate and, as I mentioned, 200,000 buys on pay-per-view. And we got this show, actually, more buys than Starrcade did at the end of the year, which was the big culmination of the Black Scorpion.
Wow.
The great Halloween Havoc animation was starting, where we went into the haunted house and got the creatures of WCW coming out. And, of course, it was dress-up night as we got ready for Halloween.
Costumes play an important role in this because this is going to sound really dumb off the top because people obviously know. And by the way, I would like to apologize for any clinking of my teeth. Due to the condition of my throat, I'll be hammering strepsils to go with my tall boys of the fruit integration Fruitopia. Fruitopia in the tall can, like the Canadian version essentially of an Arizona. This is what's up, man. If you're still drinking Arizona and the stuff's available, perish the thought.
There you go.
Also, shouts to the Korean corner store by my place, because they only charge like $1.50 for these things, and there's mad people trying to gouge on the Fruitopia Tall Boy. I've seen them as high as $2.99.
Whoa.
This is absurd. The whole idea of tall boys of high fructose corn syrup, terrible juice, fruit content questionable. The whole point is that they're supposed to be economic. Like, you know, it's so. I apologize for having a terrible voice and needing lozenges at various points.
Well, if you need a break, you just let us know. I go strictly with coffee, which I just read in Time magazine over the weekend, Jordan, that warm beverages above a certain temperature have now been added to possible causes of cancer.
Well, it makes me happy that for the most part, I am not a hot beverage dude, but I am a contextual coffee drinker. And let's just say I got a little caffeine in my system.
Well, it's always good, especially for these shows. We had Jim Ross dressed up as Al Capone.
I was thinking,
be honest, I'm throwing a dart there.
Is he like a Cuban private investigator? Like, what is going on here? Also, going back to the Halloween theme, we'll come back this when we get to the main event. But do you believe that, like I kind of had this weird blind spot sometimes. The best way I can describe it is with this anecdote. I was like 18 years old before I realized the Shell gasoline logo was a seashell.
Yes.
For like most of my life, I looked at it and thought it was like a sunrise or something. And then one day I just looked at it and went, oh my God, it's a shell. And I felt like the biggest moron. So I have these weird cognitive blind spots sometimes. And I've seen this a million times over. For enjoyment, I've looked up clips of old Barry Windham pretending to be Sting over the years. And it never dawned on me till I watched this show start to finish for this purpose that the whole idea is a continuation of someone dressed up.
You're right. I really didn't place that together. Here was Barry Windham in his Halloween costume.
Yeah.
He was going out to Sting,
as dressed
many
up
kids.
On this. Like we'll get to this with the Nasty Boys, which I think is obviously, as people who listen to the Clash of Champions
know, your jam.
This is going to be a pro-Nasty Boys podcast in a major way. So the way they integrate their costumes in hilarious fashion, Tony Schiavone, who's dressed up as a fan of the opera with lipstick, like pronounced lipstick, for no reason I can fathom. This show, watching it, I realized, like, oh, that's the theme. Like, everyone's dressing up. It actually plays a significant role in several of the matches and the actual direct falls. And it just continues into the main event.
And Pauly dangerously as Dracula.
He throws out his teeth immediately. So, you know, we get to enjoy. I would have liked if Paul Heyman at least tried to keep the fake fangs in for the first match of the evening.
Were you a bigger fan of Jim Ross and Paul Heyman in 1990 or in 2001? Because they had a different dynamic.
Well, also, speaking of a different dynamic, they have a different dynamic a few weeks later. Because I was incredibly... I was not really feeling Ross and Dangerously when we did the Thanksgiving Thunder Clash of the Champions. Paulie Dangerously was terrible. Like, the way they collectively sold the Black Scorpion thing was miserable. I feel like we spent a lot of time straight making fun of the commentary. This time around, actually, there's several back and forth exchanges that make me feel like I'm getting, you know, prime Vince and Jesse, prime Gorilla and Jesse, Heenan and just about anyone in his prime. Like, I feel like I'm getting some of those vibes sometimes. So, like, I feel like the jury's, like, I would say 2001 because, like, established characters, like, a very solid dynamic. But here, where they're just kind of feeling it out, I don't know. I feel like I want to watch more shows where they're on the stick together, because a few weeks later, I think they're abysmal. I actually kind of like them on this show.
Tony Schiavone brings out Ricky Morton and his replacement tonight, Tommy Rich, as Morton gives a shout-out to Robert Gibson.
The injured Robert Gibson.
Yes, who had blown out his knee and had gone off for surgery, and said they're going to trick the Midnight Express tonight. And Rich says that tonight is going to be the greatest night of wrestling in the history of wrestling.
Well, I mean, this is why Tommy Rich was made NWA champion.
So
not at all because he had sex with Jimmy Barnett.
Some of the finest hyperbole here. Gary Michael Capetta is our ring announcer, and that takes us into our opening match. As
what's Gary Capetta dressed as? Is he a casino dealer?
Gary Michael Capetta is dressed as Gary Michael Capetta, which
well, I mean, he kind of judged it up a bit because he's wearing like a high-waisted tuxedo with a red jacket that has like long tails. So I mean, like, he stepped it up for Halloween, but like, I mean, he just kind of looks like a crap stealer in like the 19th century or something.
Maybe that'll be Bruce Buffer, UFC 200. Maybe he'll take from the Gary Michael
big, big long red tails. Can I also say at this point, like right at this point, as we go to the hard camera and focus in on Gary Michael Capetta, there's a man, the hard camera side in this, good fan watching. WWE shows from this era, I feel like not as good. Just, you know, even though they do a good job of trying to get kids and stuff, I feel like unless you get some real drunk up ladies with big teased hair during a Rick Rude segment, you don't really get that much fun people watching. There's good people staring here. I'd like to point out at this point, third row, kind of to the left of your screen, hard camera side, there's a man who appears to be Walter Sobchak from The Big Lebowski.
Wow.
Like, and not like, oh, he looks like John, as you showed me. I knew, yeah, dude, that, we'll talk about that, dude, because I have a note about him and his shirt and the
okay,
whole combination. So, yeah, there's a man that looks exactly like Walter Sobchak. Obviously, The Big Lebowski has not come out yet. The Coen brothers, at this point in time, they've just made Blood Simple. You know, they're not quite there yet. And again, I would like to stress, this man doesn't look like John Goodman. He looks like Walter Sobchak.
Wow. Do you have, like, the shades on and everything? I missed
And they're
this
tinted.
Guy.
I don't know. He has. It looks like he has a vest or something, but it definitely has front pockets. And just his shape, his beard, his hair. Walter Sobchak's in the house. Shut the fuck up, Donnie.
I mean, this was in Illinois. What a Roseanne crossover.
Oh. Check that out.
Look at that. Tommy Rich and Ricky Morton.
What's Ricky Morton dressed as? He's got a nice ponytail here.
Ricky Morton was dressed as a man that was very much trying to turn back the clock in 1990, looks-wise, but you were starting to see Ricky Morton
cracking.
Age.
Yeah. Well,
yes.
I mean, he owns it so hard now. You know what I mean? He's just never, like, he's made that his gimmick, just like the saddest dad rocker who can't give it up, and it's charming. Also, Ricky Morton, I think we can safely say in this match, given how profound the dynamic is, Ricky Morton's playing Ricky Morton for Halloween.
He was Ricky Morton in peril for about 13 minutes of this 14-minute match. Some hilarious stuff here was Ross just riding Jim Ross, asking if they rock and roll in Oklahoma, and asking if Southerners can rock and roll in regards to Tommy Rich teaming with Ricky Morton. They did a crisscross spot. There was a Hurricane Rana by Morton. And then the Midnights just got the heat on Orton. And dangerously notes how... Orton's gonna get a
shout out here though, because in a few minutes, Bobby Eaton's gonna hit an RKO out of nowhere, I believe. I believe that is a thing in this match. Also, should point out for gimmick purposes, we missed a costume. Our boy, Richard Marley. Rocky King, aka Richard Marley, who at this point, with the exit of Buddy Roberts, has kind of become the roadie for the old fabulous Freebirds. He is dressed up as Robert Gibson, but
yes.
Crippled.
Yes. He's out later with the Freebirds for that match. Yes. So he will be coming our way. We also got Paulie dangerously breaking down the martial arts skills of Stan Lane, showing some great...
Savate
kicks. I mean, this was Stan Lane. I mean, really
ahead of his time, karate, right? He's like a karate dude. I mean, he's basically doing Bischoff spots.
Cornette uses a racket and dangerously compares him to Richard Nixon. I thought we might get a racketeering joke here.
You know how that Cornette is fed up with this shit on the way out? Think of the pageantry. Think of all the costuming and everything. Cornette doesn't even have a fancy racket case. It's literally just straight out of the sporting goods section. No effort put in. There's no sequins. There's no color scheme. It's literally just like Wilson or whatever. Cornette is just over this shit.
There were more Savate kicks by Lane to Morton, and then they hit the rocket launcher with Eaton landing on the ramp on top of Morton, the move that has now been rechristened in WWE as the Bada Boom Shakalaka, which the announcers are now calling. So that's a lone reason for you to watch your next Enzo and Cass match.
I was going to say, I love that I've never heard that yet.
Moro Ronaldo will be shouting that for the next tag match that they win.
I knew immediately whose finisher it would be.
That was it.
Also, the... The Midnights, who, by the way, I know why licensed music isn't going to be used on the network, but it really hurts Midnight Mashes.
Yes.
Because I didn't even think, speaking of like those cognitive blind spots, when they come out and like their intro, I'm just like, man, the Midnights music really sucks. And then I think, oh, right, the network, they can't use it. And then the worst part, the Shell Gasoline part, I go, yeah, what did the Midnights come out to? It took me like 5 minutes before I was like, oh, the theme from the Midnight Express, you moron. That's what the WWE Network is doing to you. You know, you go back and watch this stuff, you forget. The Midnight's entrances used to be awesome.
It was great. And, I mean, for those that hadn't seen the movie, it was also the famous Coast-to-Coast theme.
Yeah.
It was...
Giorgio Moroder, baby. The disco classic. It is the greatest disco song ever made.
Man, between that and Scarface, look what that guy gave to professional wrestling. Scott Hall, The Midnight Express, many people reaping his art. Morton hit a Hurricane Rana identified as a Japanese head scissors.
Yes. You notice, I think, we'll get to Scotty's Frankensteiner later, as I think you know to call it properly
of course.
Now.
I'm always reminded.
JR apparently needs a reminder, though. That's a Frankenstein. Also, have we seen the dude in the picture? I believe we've already seen him. The dude you pulled up the picture of. Should we give that man a shout-out since we actually just mentioned the Frankenstein?
Go on our Twitter. This photo will be up there of Frankenstein with a hat.
University of Michigan for the Steiners.
Exactly.
And what does his shirt say, Johnny?
I can't even read. I've been what? Frankensteined? That's awesome.
I've been Frankenstein.
That is fantastic. I didn't even know what the shirt had read, but here he is in the Michigan hat. I wonder if this was a plant. This is too creative.
There's actually, there's one reason that I think, like, I buy it a bit
more.
Didn't
have good seats, by the way.
There is a lot of Michigan love. They, especially during the Steiners match, there's a dude, like, in a Michigan, like, rugby sweater or something like that, a few rows up. And, he gets a lot of hard camera side play. Although, again, he's got a prominent piece of Michigan gear on. He ends up on the hard camera side. Maybe Jim Herd's up to semantics here.
There was a leg drop off the top by Bobby Eaton.
And it's beautiful. Beautiful like Bobby. The Midnights, they don't just like... This is a good match if you're going to watch like Ricky Morton just be Ricky Morton for literally 95% of the match. Because the Midnights get a ton of good offense in. Get the rocket launcher, the leg drop, the savat kicks. Like, you get multiple spots where...
Well, they were getting in the greatest hits here because it was...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
This is it.
They're literally...
This is it.
Yeah, they're done.
This is the season finale. And as he's
no,
down...
this is the series finale, dude. This is the end of the show.
You're right.
It's going off the air.
Yeah, this was like the Monday Nitro going on their season finale from Panama Beach. Heyman says he's down like Buster Douglas. And as I'm watching Stan Lane delivering these kicks to the body, playing to the crowd, you know who this guy is? Stan Lane in 1990 is Luke Rockhold.
Oh, yeah, I'll support this.
What a parallel.
Oh, man. Well, good thing he didn't fight like Regal or something like that. Would have eaten the left hand.
And then there's the tag made to Tommy Rich. And Rich, who's just been cruising on the apron this whole match, comes in and he goes to the top and he gets hit with the racket as Heyman yells that he's the Andre Agassi of professional wrestling. And the Southern boys come out, they attack Cornette, and it leads to Rich using the racket to Stan Lane behind the referee's back, and they pin Stan Lane, sweet Stan, at 14 minutes. And Rich and Ricky Morton triumphant over the soon-to-be outgoing Midnight Express. A very, very solid tag match.
You left out the great part where I believe there's like a sunset flip type situation on Stan Lane by Ricky Morton, I believe. And we get an RKO out of nowhere, even though it's very sloppy, by Bobby Eaton. You get like a diving three quarters face buster in 1990 from Bobby Eaton. The Midnights get so much good 1990, especially for the NWA, where like, and they can make it good because we'll get to this with the Horsemen and Doom, but this is still the era and the territory of punch kick, punch kick, punch kick, punch kick, punch kick. So to see the Midnights get a lot of like, good offense in, very nice.
Yeah, this was a really strong tag match on a show that had a number of them. And Schiavone is then with Sting. And he doesn't want Sid to have his, quote,
butt
overloading his you know. And then he realizes he screwed up his own line and says his mouth overload his you know what. And clarifies, yes, I'm excited.
And then does that weird thing that Sting always does when he screws up on promos. Just starts acting erratically and like saying weird things and talking
turning
about how
pumped
he is. Yeah, he just like, Sting, anytime he blows a promo in this era, which he kind of always does in some way. Like, great energy, obviously. He's not like the worst of the worst. He makes up for it with some charisma and enthusiasm.
There were many parallels to him and former tag partner Ultimate Warrior at this time.
Warrior is so crazy, though, that it's consistent.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like his stream of consciousness rambling might be insane.
Sting was never incoherent.
Yeah, he just screws up.
He was bad with delivery.
Warrior, but yeah, the delivery on Warrior is incredible.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, once that truck of insane gets going downhill, it's unstoppable. Like, have you ever seen a Warrior promo where he actually, like, he's saying insane things, but have you ever seen a Warrior promo where he actually fumbles over his words?
Yeah, oh, of course.
Well, like, but to a point where you just, like, don't buy the idea that this guy is a raving maniac, you know?
Oh, you would see him stumble, but he was always, like, whatever turns you took in the promo, he was gonna turn it around, and it was Jimmy Snuka-like, where it was, this guy's making no sense if you were actually to transcribe what he is saying, but you never got that sense if you were just listening to this guy.
Sting, the more stuff I watch from his era, you know, I feel like I kind of bought the idea forever without really thinking about it and really going back and watching a lot of these shows. Like, nah, this is just a man shortchanged by time. You know, he got Flair too late when, you know, this regime was coming in and kind of tanked everything. And the more I watch it, I just think, like, really, would this dude have really been the guy? He's not an awful pick to kind of, like, lead your company and try to be your top face. It's not terrible. But I feel like the more I watch, the idea that this guy was somehow, like, shortchanged by, like, circumstance and timing...
Did it hurt both Warrior and Sting in 1990, the fact that they were put in the roles and the guys that were the previous stars in Hogan and Flair were still very much present on mm-hmm. the programming? Would it have been any different if those guys weren't around?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, the one thing we can say is I'm not saying that Sting didn't get a bad hand because it's like the Black Scorpion.
Yeah. That's And take Ric Flair out of 1990?
Yeah.
What does that promotion look like?
Seriously. Huh? Dude, I mean, and they're letting dudes go that can be things. The skyscrapers have broken up because Kane the Undertaker is coming in a few weeks to help out DiBiase at the Survivor Series and be champion and take the belt off Hogan almost immediately, within a year. Survivor Series, not 1 year, yeah. He takes the belt off of Hogan. So think about this. They've just let Mean Mark Callis go in like 54 weeks. He's going to be WWF World Champion.
Yeah.
That's the kind of stuff that's happening here.
And here they had poor Kevin Nash as a master blaster.
Oh, we could have had Big Sexy right here.
Could you have imagined?
That might have been an error for Nash, too. Because Nash always uses these weird excuses like, oh, like, there's like a lot of heart disease in my family. Like, and I'm a big guy. It's like a giraffe. Like, got to pump blood to, like, you know, I'm so big. And, like, I'm worried. Because I was like, he missed, like, a WCW pay-per-view, right, during the NWO era. And he just no-shows and basically said, like, he was worried about his heart or something like that. Like, Nash was, like, famous for just being like, oh, dude, like, I'm worried about my heart. So, like, he would just one of his excuses to not work hard in matches. I would like to see like a 1990 Kevin Nash before his dad has a heart attack and he sees all that stuff and has gotten bumped up and he's still young in the game. You know, when he's still in Secret of the Ooze Super Shredder physical status, we might have got some more bumps on the house.
So as we get back to the Schiavone interview with Sting, then we get Black Scorpion coming over the loudspeaker and out comes a druid in all black who takes a helpless female fan from the crowd.
Just yanks her by the arm.
Just grabs her, places her behind a curtain on the stage for our impromptu magic show.
Can we also say that this is how you know the territory has gone? And I know this isn't like, you know, Greensboro or anything like that. I know in Chicago. But thinking about, you know, Crockett into Turner, you know, when you see like the Flair turn on Dusty, that solidifies.
Could you have imagined if it was Dusty feuding with the Black Scorpion?
Holy shit. Dusty is the Midnight Rider.
Oh my god!
So think about this: that famous angle might literally be the best execution of a turn angle probably ever. When they and the Russians beat up Dusty in the cage and turn on him, just beat the shit out of him. They end up in the cage. They have to beat Dusty for even longer. Because the horsemen literally can't leave the cage. Because so many fans are jumping onto the cage.
Oh, yeah.
Ole Anderson is, like, going Ron Artest in the stands in Malice at the Palace, socking people in the face. They have to wait, like, 20 minutes in the cage so they can get the police there to help escort the heels out of the cage. Ole Anderson almost died because he was stabbed by a man in his 70s. Like, a 70-year-old man. Saw Ole Anderson is such a horrific heel. He fucking stabbed him, John, and nearly killed him. Can you imagine? I would like to think that Southern justice would be meted out if in 1980, the Black Scorpion yanks a woman by the arm and these kayfabe marks are like, this is unacceptable behavior. We have to kill the Black Scorpion.
I'm just imagining taking that kind of heat and placing it to today and how they would talk about a member of the WWE Universe came out of the stands and stabbed him in the calf.
Like,
take that level of heat and apply it to today's classification of the fan base in WWE speak.
It's but you would never get that heat ever again. You know, it's easy to say that, like,
there's that story though on that independent show recently.
No, I guess that's true.
A woman pulled a gun on the heel.
Well, I mean, that's
showing Georgia, I believe.
That's Georgia, you say. Can't believe it. This is the territory we're talking about. This is the territory, like, Mid-Atlantic and Jim Crockett. This is a place where if this gimmick happened 10 years earlier, I like to think that you get the mix of people that would think it was real, or even if they kind of knew, they were suspending disbelief to a point where it became dangerous for them and other people, and they would not tolerate this, John. The Black Scorpion could have died weeks before Starrcade if we had proper old NWA fans to clean up this bullshit for us.
Well, if you look at two different generations of WCW, this would be the first one where with Jim Herd, a lot of it was, how do we compete with the WWF mm-hmm. and get that younger audience? And then later we saw when, I mean, think about this. Think of this idea if Nitro did not go head-to-head with Raw. If mm-hmm. Raw was on another night of the week mm-hmm. and we didn't get those direct ratings comparisons, and you look at the business, WCW was doing well into 1999. If you just assess this on its own, yes, creative was fumbling in 99, but how much of that was that we've got to catch this? It was so much focused on their competition rather than just their core product and satisfying that audience. They were in this awful trap by the end of 1990 that instead of taking that audience that we had cultivated in the mid-80s and they had stumbled with Dusty by the end booking the territory, but instead it was like we're trying to change our product to something it was not, and it's upsetting our audience that we already had, and we're not growing at the same rate either and taking from the WWF.
I'll go even deeper on this. I think one reason this happens is when we're talking about trying to ape the competition and whatever, for the most part, throughout pro wrestling history, I guess you could argue now that the WWE product itself, especially with Jean-Paul Levesque with some reins, you're trying to get this emulation of the indies and international wrestling and so on and so forth. But for most of the post-territory era, it's been people trying to ape Vince McMahon, and Vince McMahon has been successful in many endeavors, but I'm going to break some news to all of you. Vince McMahon is kind of a dumbass and has a lot of crazy ideas and historically has lucked into a lot of things. You know, he got people in charge that could have made Steve Austin Chili McFreeze. You know what I mean? We got Rocky Maivia the blue chipper. You know what I mean? Like, almost anyone other than Hogan, you know what I mean? Almost everyone that Vince has kind of like handpicked in some way, I guess, and to a lesser extent, Cena, which was very shrewdly done and, you know, carries on his Marine series of straight to DVDs and the like. But for the most part, Vince has blown it an awful lot in a lot of different ways. And there have been tremendous periods of WWE growth and success that have been in spite of his efforts. And so for his competition, because he's the industry leader, to constantly think whatever this guy's doing is the kind of page we got to get on. We got to get in Vince McMahon's head and find out what he's up to. No wonder. You're trying to ape someone who deep down inside is a sociopathic crazy person who he hits some damn big home runs. He's like a Dave Kingman from the Mets. Vince's going to have a lot of strikeouts every season, but man, when he bombs it, he's going to send the Rock right to Hollywood.
As we get back, the screen then reveals that the woman is gone. Smoke and pyro in minimal forms are...
No one seems panicked, by the way. This becomes the default emotion for the show.
Well, Paulie Dangerously was very panicked.
At the end of the segment...
That ain't right! That ain't right!
Dangerously at the end of the segment is as bad as it gets for Dangerously on this particular show, I believe. But
in fairness, I don't know how they sell this.
Well, I believe when they do the interstitial after this, Ross says like multiple times, this is bewildering. I think he says it two or three times. That bewilderment is... That's the order for the day. You know, if we were doing a DVD giveaway and you were listening for a secret word, it'd be bewilderment for this show. Because when we get to Sting and Sid at the end, the crowd, Sting, Sid, like everyone looks confused. Like they're acting these things out, but it's like they're existing outside themselves in some way and can't believe what is happening in a very real meta way.
Yeah, one of the great reactions in Jim Ross's career, I want to say this was Backlash 2006, and it was when Vince had the God angle was going on, and he believed that he could cure people of diseases. And he's backstage with Candice Michelle, who has a chest cold. So he has to put his hands on Candice.
Of course.
And she is being... This is like a Benny Hinn segment, I guess, with the underlying theme that she's both being healed and possibly having an orgasm at the same time. And it ends with the climax, and they cut to Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler. And Jim Ross just looks plain as day at the camera. He turns to Jerry. What the hell was that? And we move on. And it was fantastic.
When Ross later in life, after being scarred by Vince the first time, showing up and, like, you know, he's there 2 weeks.
Jim, I have what you're going to be wearing for WrestleMania.
And he hands him a fucking toga. You know, like, you know, Ross, the punishment he's taken from Vince, like, even up to that point, you know what I mean? It's sufficient enough that when he sees, he's going to call a spade a spade. We're still in a point in 1990 where he's trying to save face. He's trying to be the company guy. He's trying so hard. But eventually Jim Ross is going to go network, and he's not going to take it anymore.
So the woman is freed and jumps into the Savior's arms, Sting.
Okay, you need to explain how this physically happens, because it's actually crazy. When the Black Scorpion disappears, he essentially goes, like, to the far side of Sting on
the adjacent
platform.
Stage that's
okay.
Behind them. Yes.
Okay, so here's the thing. The way the woman is positioned, Sting gets down off of the ramp where he's being interviewed, runs around the platform, and, like, has the chick come into his arms to, like, rescue her. Why on earth? This man has been psychologically tormenting him while he tries to defend the WCW heavyweight title for months at this point. Months. This is crazy. If someone was doing this to you IRL, if someone stalked you in this way with black magic, you'd have had a restraining order or killed them months ago. How does he not die from the ramp onto the platform and try to kick the Black Scorpion's ass? He literally runs around him and physically avoids him to, like, slowly put this woman into his arms. It is nonsensical. Like, you know,
maybe the Black Scorpion teleported.
But he, I mean, if okay, fine, do that. Have a trap door and Sting, like, tries to dive at him and he falls through it and disappears. Like, that would almost be dope.
CGI was needed in WCW 1990 booking.
No, that's the opposite. They need none of that. They need hard effects. They need anything but this. CGI only entitles them and emboldens them at this point.
Oh, I'm saying you go all in if you're going this direction, Jordan. We can't be half pregnant on this booking. So
the crowd's dead, by the way. As you might expect.
This was so dull, but props to Turner Home Video for keeping this in.
Yeah, I mean, we missed.
You kind of have to. I mean, this is their A storyline at the time, and the Black Scorpion promises that we will meet again. Ross is stunned. Pauly dangerously just
over the top selling.
Yeah, that ain't right. That ain't right. Stuff like that is not supposed to happen. You can't be in two places at once. Which is probably what a lot of ECW talent thought when they thought that Heyman was in LA saving ECW and instead was filming Rollerball. So we then go to the Renegade Warriors against Michael Hayes and Jimmy Jam Garvin.
Bad Street, Atlanta, GA. And because they're facing a Native American tag team, prepare for some casual racism.
With little Richard Marley. And might I say, Jordan, that Michael Hayes and Jimmy Garvin, I've got to say, if you and I could ever be encapsulated by a tag team in 1990, this is the closest we're going to get, I think.
So, I mean, this disappoints me because you're obviously thinking you're Michael Hayes.
Well, I kind of have to be. Like, you and Jimmy Garvin at this time period, I mean, it's
that,
just
that really disappoints
natural.
Me because I am not... I like the Freebirds fine, but... You always, like, hear it kind of, like, couched up, like, Hayes is this great talker, Jimmy Garvin's this great worker, and Buddy Roberts had, like, this easy combination of the two. And I watch Jimmy Garvin, and I just think, meh.
Did you watch their Hall of Fame induction?
No, I didn't.
Oh, the highlight is their entrance.
The highlight of this.
I watched it multiple times.
The highlight of this is also their entrance, as always. Also, can I say that I commented at Clash of Champions last time that Michael Hayes is one of the worst dancers, even for just, like, awkward white dude. But
Michael Hayes, Shawn Michaels.
But we exactly as we talked about, Michaels owned it in a way with the ridiculous music, no matter who's doing the vocal, that you would just think, I hate this guy. And it gets over. They're dancing here, like, obviously, like, it upsets people, whatever, but it's so bad that it's just, I don't have the reaction of like, damn, I hate this guy. I just kind of look at it and go like, ew. Also, though, the move Michael Hayes always does when he gets up on the rope and points to Jimmy Garvin while like rotating his fingers at him is, it actually kind of melts my heart.
I almost feel you need to watch this Hall of Fame entrance that they made.
Okay.
So if I can pull this up, we'll keep.
So, okay, I'll cover a lot of this. I'll take over play by play duty here, so you can look this up on the network.
You know what? It might be better actually if you just search right now, Freebirds Hall of Fame 2016, because I imagine it's up there because this is how we're recording the show on my computer here. So
okay, that's
if
that's
you
fair.
Find it, I think you owe it to yourself to just watch the minute.
Oh, okay. This WWE clip looks like it appears to be.
Yeah, I'm sure.
They're already on stage.
Oh, they're on the stage. It's the entrance we need to see. Okay, well, I'll look for it as we continue this review. This is Chris and Mark Youngblood's first pay-per-view event. The Freebirds are out to Bad Street, USA, and as Jordan mentioned, it's Richard Marley wearing Robert Gibson's tights and mocking him.
This is actually where the Black Scorpion thing's over. We've been cleansed of that at least for a moment. And this is good. The interplay with Ross and Heyman's actually... Like, Ross gets heat on the match by, like, he makes you hate the Freebirds for mocking Robert Gibson being injured and having this, as he calls him, a gopher and a flunky, dress up as an injured Robert Gibson, looking ridiculous in the rock and roll outfit and stumbling around on crutches that he doesn't need. Ross gets so much heat on the match because he just loses it. Like, you feel like he genuinely cares about Robert Gibson and can't believe that he would be mocked this way. And like, where's the Halloween spirit?
Ross calls him a flunky and a gopher.
This is exactly what I'm talking about that we don't get a few weeks later at Clash of the Champions. Heyman plays brilliantly off of this and says, he's a gopher. Go for your throat if you say it to him.
Oh, that's great.
And then he immediately afterwards, Heyman basically says that the Freebirds are going to make sure that the Renegade Warriors can't feed their little Indian children and they'll have to send them back to basket weaving.
Yes, as was noted here, and preventing them from feeding their Indian families.
Woof.
dangerously compared the Freebirds to Crippler Ray Stevens.
Luthez. He says Luthez. There's one other person.
Was it Pat O'Connor, maybe? It was somebody else. But Luthez and Ray Stevens were definitely mentioned here as comparisons. Ross also cut this scathing promo about...
Ross is incredible on this match. Ross is the best performer. Yes.
He was great. And how Robert Gibson is a nice guy, and Heyman just calls him biased.
Well, yeah, well, dude, it's the perfect... It's like, again, I always use the example of Jesse Ventura, where... You know, things become real, but you still maintain that kind of pro wrestling logic. Because there's obviously, you know, that for the most part, the play-by-play guy in a booth is going to be slightly pro-face, and the color guy is going to be pro-heel. We understand this dynamic now, for the most part. And, I mean, thanks to Vince for that, you know what I mean? It was definitely a clever Vince innovation. But the interplay here is great because Ross is so plain and human emotional about it, you know what I mean? He just says, like, he's a great guy. I care about him. I consider him a friend. And Heyman completely rebuffs the idea of human emotion playing into it. And the thing is, like, in true Jesse Ventura-esque fashion, Ross is passionate and reasonable and relatable, but Heyman's right. He's the lead play-by-play guy. Your feelings don't matter. Shut up, Ross. You're supposed to be a broadcast journalist.
Ethics and broadcast journalism for professional wrestlers.
So, I mean, when you get the interplay where both people are reasonable and they're not actual human caricatures, you're doing good stuff.
Dangerously laughs about how the Freebirds have stopped five people from feeding their families. And Ross, like that, like the door was open, just shuts him down saying, not everyone is like you that still lives with your mom and father and are not concerned about whether you lose your income or not because there's no stakes involved.
Incredible. You know, and also gets dangerously over because it reaffirms like the super yuppie gimmick. Ross and Heyman are the stars of this match, really.
Both versions of them in WCW and later WWE, they were very different performers in both, but I always enjoyed these two together quite a lot because they played off each other very well. There was a long heat spot on Chris. The fans are chanting for the DDT. As Ross notes, there are some Freebird fans in the crowd tonight. And throughout this, they did announce times going by, which I think were slightly worked figures, because there didn't appear to be any edit points in this.
No.
Hayes teases the DDT, which was incredibly over at this point with the audience. And
well, I got some disappointing news about the finish there.
Chris Youngblood, who's selling this, and unfortunately in the VHS world, he was following Ricky Morton's doing exactly the same thing, and Chris Youngblood was not dressed as Ricky Morton for Halloween or
no,
portraying
him. And I mean, he's also not the actual guy either, you know?
And Hayes gets stopped as he climbs the turnbuckle, gets thrown off by Chris, and then rolls to go pin Mark. There's no reaction to this at all. Marley then gets flipped into the ring by Chris Youngblood. There's an O'Connor roll by Mark, and then Hayes comes from behind the referee's back, hits the DDT.
Does he hit it? Well, he attempts the DDT. Tell me, does his head touch the ground?
Well, it doesn't quite meet the mark. And then Garvin pins Mark Youngblood at 12 minutes 39 seconds. The big reaction was the heels hitting their finish.
Given John the Michael Hayes rotational point now.
You must watch this Freebird's entrance.
You got a cue?
It's not up
right,
yet.
Okay.
I promise.
When you get it, whenever you find it, just send me a link. I'll pop it over here. We'll slide my Twitter DMs when you find it.
Your thoughts on this tag match, and also, you know, following another tag match, this is a very tag-heavy show. I think this one kind of was what it was.
Yeah, I like good tag team wrestling, but this ain't necessarily it. Fortunately, apart from a terrible ending, something that marks Dusty and then right into this era, and then when Dusty comes back, the legacy of shit finishes is strong, but there's some reason to be excited for the Four Horsemen and Doom tag match.
Then Tony Schiavone, the Phantom of the Opera.
With lipstick on again.
Brings out Ric Flair, Sid Vicious, and Arn Anderson, who is wearing a WCW
crew shirt. Well, that was one of Arn Anderson's things. Like, even during the late era, he'd always just wear like the plain WCW shirt, which essentially is what the crew would have wore.
Which kind of fit him.
Oh,
you know?
Dude, he's one of the boys.
That's it.
Arn's just down for the company.
Arn says, four guys enter tonight. In reference to him and Ric Flair taking on Doom, there is no good guy, bad guy scenario.
We're getting very meta on this because obviously, and we actually literally talked about this in the main event last time. I said that the main event of the Clash of Champions we talked about just a few weeks later with Flair and Reed, it was a kind of a choose your own adventure thing. Like, it was very clear that it was like split and they both worked heel and face offense within the match.
Yep.
You know what I mean? So this is actually like very tweener cool, very, very ahead of its time in this way. And Arn showing why this is essentially the stuff that like Vince Russo took to a caricature level. The idea where if you're real clever, you read between the lines and realize that Arn is making an editorial comment and probably like a complimentary one, but like we're doing real stuff here. This is about men who don't like each other. This isn't, you know, Hogan against some weird monster from wherever the hell. You know, this is real dudes with real beef and there's no good guys, bad guys. It's very meta, but it's very clever. It's not, you know, it's not commentators saying like, oh, he blew that spot. Oh, he's stealing his heat.
No, that was the problem. Where this comment, you could understand what he was saying if you understand that. If you don't follow wrestling on that level, the line still works. And that always fell apart with the Russo scripted promos where it would have been Arn coming out saying, Doom doesn't want to do the job tonight,
exactly.
So we're going to have a shoot.
Yep.
So everything else on this show is fucking bullshit.
Yeah.
Sid and Arn ends up saying that Doom needs to be all the man they can be tonight, and Sid just yells, Four Horsemen forever. I love Ric Flair promo as much as the next guy, but there's nothing that really gets me pumped for a match like an Arn Anderson-style promo like this.
Arn, this is not like an Arn promo that you would ever remember, and it's not the best promo on the show, because there's a man who takes home a strap who cuts, I think, arguably the best promo of his whole career. But this is, if you had to show someone real quickly who kind of never saw Arn Anderson but got the business, the line we just talked about, it's one of a million examples you could choose, but it's one that just brilliantly typifies how brilliant this guy is, and just, like this dude just got how to make a promo to make you feel like wrestling's on the marquee, and it's real.
So that takes us into the Steiner Brothers and Doom for the United States Tag Team Championships with our referee, Mike Atkins.
Excuse me, Doom?
Sorry, I've got this all wrong. This
Are you going to write out and try to erase what I think you know is the most important part of the show to me?
I really screwed up the Nasty Boys here, taking on the Steiner Brothers United States tag titles.
Can I recreate the Nasty Boys theme on the mic filter?
you can take us right into the Nasty Boys. This was a team that I believe it was at my birthday party one year, and you gave me like a dissertation on the Nasty Boys. And
I gave parts and excerpts of this last time I was here. Just, the Nasty Boys are just the best.
And many would say this might have been their best match ever.
This. The concession brawls, it would have to be one of like the Cactus Jack, Max Payne, or maybe like the Harlem Heat one. I think that's, but there's a very weird portending of the future in the end of this match, because I think if weirdly enough, if you ask me what are the best Nasty Boys matches as a Nasty Boy aficionado, it's a concession brawl. And we're going to have concessionaires play an interesting little twist at the end of this.
So here was the Nasty Boys, just a few months away from winning the WWF tag titles at WrestleMania.
As we discussed on the Clash of the Champions, which, you know, as we've mentioned multiple times, happens like two, three weeks after this, the Nasty Boys are going to WrestleMania very quickly, like 4 months from here, and going to take the titles off the Hart Foundation. And, I mean, I want to say that the Clash of the Champions, when the Steiners run them off, like, that's almost the end of the feud. Like, it kind of ends cold. They don't resolve it because they just peace out.
The match begins and they're just brawling around the ring. Ross is going crazy here, calling the action. Sags uses a chair to Scott after an Irish whip into the guardrail. Just the crowd is really into this at the beginning.
They get it hot right off the bat, as the Nasty Boys can.
Yeah. Scott was just, he was awesome in this match.
Okay, there is such a Scott Steiner moment. We described last time that what's great about Scott Steiner is the element, it's like Lesnar, it's the element of unpredictability. I brought up the fact that he does these insane maneuvers that add strange twists and bells and whistles that make them infinitely more dangerous for no particular reason. Sags goes for a superplex, like right off the top. You're like, oh wow, this match is bumping. We're like 45 seconds into this. Sags goes for a superplex. Steiner, even though he falls, I like it because it somehow makes it look legit. He does like a hard go behind to counter the superplex. And then runs up onto the rope. Here's the thing. They do it almost too real, because in modern wrestling, the dude would go down and he would sit on the top rope and step up for his guy. Sags is standing on the second rope. Steiner steps on the second rope. They're standing below the top rope. So Steiner hits a perfect belly-to-belly quasi-superplex because they're not on the top. But think about that. He has to pull Jerry Sags' fat ass directly vertical so high that his legs don't hit the top rope. And he still throws him halfway across the ring, which, by the way, as we're getting into more tag team matches here, one thing that really hurts this card, I think some of the tag matches, this ring is so small.
Yeah.
This is a tiny ring. And the fact they made it orange with orange ropes, like somehow it seems like really claustrophobic, even above and beyond. This is a tiny ring. So, I mean, maybe not the most impressive that Steiner throws him across it, but there's some problems with the ring.
Sags takes this giant belly to belly. The crowd roars. Scott then goes for a tiger driver as Heyman yells, "Tilt-a-whirl!"
Also, at one point, I believe after he hits the belly to belly, Heyman says, Scotty flashes the guns and gets like super roid pumped, and the fans go wild, and Heyman says, "Bunch of animals cheering for something like that."
these grand amplitude throws. Rick hits a bulldog off the shoulders.
Electric chair, a bulldog. We're like 2 minutes into this match.
This was crazy.
We're working, pal. Also, can we say another reason to love the Nasty Boys? Dude, for unathletic, fat, gross dudes, they bump and sell so well.
They never got enough credit for just being like, especially the Steiners, where it suited them so well, where Rick could deliver a suplex and you never knew, is the guy taking this ready to be taking this? Because it really doesn't matter. He's getting thrown either way, and added that added element to just the intensity of this.
Nasty Boys are great foils for the Steiners, because like, they want to fight and get fucked up, and they want to do the Roddy Piper thing where like they call it a fight instead of a wrestling match and imagine that somehow this is real. And you need people like that when Scotty's going to be doing Frankensteiners that drive you a million miles an hour on the top of your face, and these hyper dangerous like suplexes where the ring ropes are in the way and all this wild. He doesn't do it in this match, but the backflip fall away slam he does. These things are so unnecessarily dangerous. And the Nasty Boys, even if he didn't do it yet, Knobs and Sags would both be there to take the square driver.
Knobs grabs a chair, and right behind the referee's back...
This is a bad theme for the show. So many, especially this, there's a million chair shots, and again, the ring is so small, you can't suspend disbelief that, like, if someone tiptoed behind you in this ring, you'd hear it.
The Nasties then get the heat off the chair shot spot onto Scott. Domino stretch, bear hug by Sags, and then Scott breaks out of the bear
after
hug.
After an hour, man. There's two bear hug spots in this. The Sags-Scott one goes like 3 minutes, and there's this Knobs one in a little bit that goes, again, way too long. The fact they repeat the spot and go for length is upsetting. We'll criticize the Nasty Boys there.
Scott then belly-to-bellies himself out of the bear hug, and Rick murders Knobs with a lariat, and the crowd goes nuts at these two just getting the shit.
So many clotheslines in this, and stiff clotheslines in this match.
They hit a spike pile driver to Scott Steiner.
Great looking spike pile driver too.
So Rick was supposed to come in with the chair shot save, but he was late on the save. So Knobs had to stop the count before Rick got into the ring, which looked awkward.
Yeah, that's a rough blown spot because like it literally looks like Knobs like intentionally breaks up his own match winning pin basically.
And then to make up for the delay, Rick slices open Sag's head with the chair.
This is great because he hits Sags directly in the back of the head. Sags blades down the middle of his forehead. No way that bump could ever happen, but Sags is bleeding for the business, and in fairness, he cuts it perfect. It goes like, it basically drips right into his front tooth gap. It's a great blade position.
Good visual. Scott breaks out of Sags' Boston Crab, keeps him away from Rick, then Knobs misses.
Great push-up flip thing. That like Steiner's escape from the Boston Crab is, dude, it looks like a mini Canadian destroyer or something.
Knobs misses a splash in the corner, and then Scott clotheslines Sags and makes the hot tag to Rick. Crowd erupts for the hot tag, and Rick just deadlifts Knobs for another belly-to-belly. And
dude, he almost
Knobs
falls.
Like stumbles as he's about to take this.
Yeah, it looks like he almost like steps on Rick's foot or something. The fact that he gets him so well while clearly falling backwards is muy bueno.
So the Nasties then dump Rick to the floor, come back with a double clothesline to both off the top, the Steiners do. And then
so many good clotheslines in this.
Yeah, Scott pulls Sags to the floor and into the post and then hits the Frankensteiner.
And oh boy, does he take it like Scotty always does. No wonder this guy's crazy. You know what I mean? You watch the early 90s, he's clearly already kind of quasi-psychotic jock bro who should not be doing these amounts of steroids. But no wonder when he turns it up, he's a lunatic. Because this era, every time he does a Frankensteiner, he's smashing his own face and concussing himself and no-selling it every time.
This replay where Knobs is spiked on the top of his head.
Knobs also gets it incredibly bad. It's a Steiner's match. Everyone's getting hurt.
Yes.
Everybody in the club's getting shot.
This was the Franken CTE. as the Steiners get the win, 15-24, and retain their tag titles. I thought this was an awesome tag match.
The Nasties, man. The Nasties are the best. And the best part is immediately about to happen. Can we go into the Scott Steiner promo?
So afterwards, there's a post-match attack to the Steiners, and they throw Rick shoulder first into the post. And because of the editing of this, we instantly go to their reaction, which is, you know, theoretically 30 minutes later, but it's instantaneous here on the VHS.
Which makes it look hilarious, too, because when they go to the Steiner promo, like they get the heat by smashing Rick, and Rick's injured. And obviously, like you said, it makes sense, because in the promo, they're talking about how Rick's injured, and that's why he's not.
And it's just Scott.
Promo. Yeah. And then... Because on the video edit, it literally looks like the Nasty Boys got, like, Cher-level costume change ability here. Because, as I mentioned, in a bit of strange future-telling, a bit of maybe it's destiny, this is what sparks the idea. When Jerry Sags attacks Scott Steiner, what is he dressed as, John Pollock?
He is dressed as a vendor.
Smashes him with a giant plastic flat of popcorn while wearing a weird vendor outfit with a giant wig and beard. It is possibly the best part of this entire show. I like to imagine this is where the Nasties just realized the concession brawl. That's like Eddie Gilbert had already done at this point, right? The famous Eddie Gilbert one had already happened.
Yes.
Yeah. So hopefully they maybe saw that, got inspired and realized like, that's our thing. That's our match. That's our table, ladders, and chairs, or tables match if we're the Dudleys. That's our thing.
And I also like that to set up this attack by two vendors, it was Scott yelling that the Nasties bit off more than they could chew.
Incredible.
Right before the attack. And then Knobs, after they've killed Scott.
Food puns, by the way. Maybe that's a Jim Herd thing. Do we have any pizza puns around?
Yes. Knobs then yells, and he's so fired up in this promo. He yells, quote, "You think you're scared? We're not scared. Your brother, don't know his name. The war has just begun."
Hey! Steiners! Steiners! Hey! You've been walking around real bad and bald! You think you're scared? We're not scared! Your brother don't know his name, and you're not in there! The war has just begun, baby!
Awesome.
I love this.
It's like I've heard Dave Meltzer make this point before, and I think it's a salient one. I won't say like important or crucial. I think it's salient that if Scott Steiner, you had had, if he could have taken the late career persona where he's so deep in the grips of insanity that he becomes that classic pro wrestler who believes it, which is honestly, I mean, it makes you a terrifying person and like a sociopath, but to play a character, it makes you, you know, like Hulk Hogan is a crazy person. Like he's, even though he's not full blown like Jim Hellwig and believes it to that extent, when you hear him talk about anything,
no, like, read his first book.
Dude, he's a crazy carny. Never forget this. So if Steiner had had the late career Big Papa Pump, Holly, if you hear me, persona with the physical ability he had early on, this dude just, I mean, like, he wouldn't have been a rocker in Austin, but holy shit would this guy have been over as hell.
Shivani, afterwards, dangerously just laughs the attack off and then just inserts that Chicago is a second-class city.
Awesome.
Doom, actually in this match.
Not the good Doom, as people who listen to my easily, possibly misinterpreted rant about what the Doom character should have been forever, by staying phantasmagorical, horrifying, visions of black suburban terror with two faceless black dudes led by a minxy woman. But again, good stuff here. You know, we get the quasi tweener angle, and surprisingly, Butch Reed, he's decent in Mid-South. But honestly, watching this and watching 3 weeks later, I'm impressed with how well Butch Reed conducts and comports himself.
This might have been the finest 4 weeks of his career.
Yeah, like Butch Reed, I don't know if he came in with some money or just what the deal was, but these last weeks of 1990, Butch Reed's in the zone.
Doom against Ric Flair and Arn Anderson.
And you know what time it is, Johnny? You know what time it is? It's time for Jim Ross to start masturbating about college football furiously.
Well, and for Paulie Dangerously to push those buttons, because, first of all, I want to ask you this question. Fan or critic of the stage entrance with the talent coming out on?
Okay, so we made fun of it for being long last time, but I think between this show and, again, a show a few weeks later, and thinking about some other matches and events where I can think about things based around that ramp, I really like it, and I think more like some kind of indie promotion should seek to emulate it or something like that. There is the Midnight's match when they do the rocket launcher from the ring onto the ramp. You know?
Yeah.
Like, the best offense in Sting and Sid, which sucks, like, happens on the ramp. You watch a Pillman match with the ramp, it's insane. The ramp, people are really using it effectively. It's a shame that Bill Watts is going to come and screw this up and take this kind of dynamic away so pronounced. But, no, I love the ramp, and there's a ton of matches in this, and in this era, where they use it very effectively.
I thought, it really hit me, just watching Flair and Arn. Like, they looked like stars walking out on this stage.
Oh, absolutely.
I thought looked really good here. And as you said off the top, Ross notes how Ron Simmons played for coach Bobby Bowden and Dangerously just says Bowden is a big fan of his. And Ross, disgust in his tone.
He doesn't even know who you are.
Just no-sells it, saying Bobby Bowden has never heard of you. Awesome.
The best part of this is very early on, Ross, after naming a bunch of college football laurels for Butch Reed, who he compares to Lawrence Taylor as a headhunting linebacker in college, and talking about Ron Simmons, he says very quickly and very early, but this isn't the football field. This isn't a football game. This is, you know, men going at each other. This is a wrestling match. This is a test of wills. But yet, doesn't stop him from incessantly talking about college football immediately afterwards. He just can't help himself.
Dangerously brings up Flair's tag title runs in the 70s so that he is not out of his element here.
Three-time NWA World Tag Team Champion.
And
Dangerously dropping knowledge.
And as you mentioned, you're right about Ross saying nothing compares to the intensity of these matches in WCW. Irish Whip, Flair flips over and kills a cameraman in the process.
Dude, he does the inside out spot, and do you think that's like an intentional dick rib? Like, is that the Shawn Michaels, I hate cameraman, get the fuck out of my way, like always grabbing people and pushing them? Because Flair, dude, you're running towards the ropes. These dudes are standing up there, they have, like most of the cameramen they have, I don't know if it was Dusty in the UIC, they have like the filter masks on, like big fat dudes holding cameras. Flair obviously can see this guy. He flips over on the side he's on. That's got to be intentional on some Shawn Michaels stuff.
They fought on the ramp, and Simmons goes to throw Flair back in off the stage, and he sends Rick face first into the middle rope, and he just bounces back and has to just send himself back into the ring. Heyman suggests that this might be the rope-a-dope strategy that Flair and Arn are implementing here. Flair and Arn work over the left knee of Simmons in the corner, and you see Flair and Arn kind of working heel here with the figure four double-teaming behind.
Figure four early and really long, too. Simmons, like, I'm surprised they, like, let him... Like, he sits in it for, like, 2 minutes and essentially powers out. Yeah. However, the small ring, even though it's still not great for this match, it at least allows Arn and Flair to cheat really effectively. The problem is they do the spot over and over again where, you know, they're trying to portray, you know, Ron Simmons being, like, power Ricky Morton and Butchery trying to, like, run in and save him as Arn and Rick very sort of cleverly play on the idea he's a hothead, like induce him to get in the ring. And is it Randy Anderson who refs this?
Yes, Randy Anderson.
Yeah, Randy Anderson. But it's Randy Anderson. His nickname's literally Pee-wee. He's trying to stop Butch Reed like over and over and over again from coming in to this tiny ring where he could push Randy Anderson and like hit Flair and Arn on the other side of the ring. So it helps when Arn and Flair are like, you know, punching the dude from the apron and like holding each other's hands and rest holds. By the way, great rest holds here. Arn's like the best at it, where like you work the limb or whatever, apply it, but then just stand up and beat the shit out of it for a minute and then go back to it. This is good old school slugging rest. And this is the best of punch kick, punch kick, punch kick.
The horsemen continue with the heat on Simmons. Simmons then eventually runs Flair into the guardrail on the floor, and there's this bad flying clothesline by Simmons that Ross calls out as not connecting with all of it to Flair. And Reed finally gets tagged in, and he goes for a drop kick. Flair goes down off of it, doesn't...
We noted in the Flair-Reed match a few weeks later that Reed threw a legit drop kick. The one he throws on Arn here, not bad either.
Arn tries for a pile driver, and then a flying shoulder block by Reed coming off the top knocks him over.
Too. Yeah. Arn, like, one of my problems with spots like that where someone goes up the top rope is the dude always has to wait. But they, like Arn, just, what a craftsman. The way he does it, where, like, he struggles with the pile driver because Simmons is a big dude, he gets him up a bit, and, like, he's kind of, like, he's trying to, like, jockey for position, so he, like, you know, turns to actually be facing Reed, but you have a legitimate reason that he's doing it, and then he tries to do, like, the Mick Foley tights thing, like, as a last resort, and right as he sort of gets to this plan B, plan C, gets absolutely decked with a beautiful clothesline. Just Arn Anderson just sewing the whole thing together, making it tight, the craftsmanship.
You look at, I mean, had he not had to retire in the situation he had, and you look at that kind of, that Bob Armstrong authority figure, that he's the regional badass that everyone respects, that Arn could have been used in, where he could have done the one match a year. I think that guy could have been so effective in that kind of a role, where you had so many of the heel GMs that Arn in that role, where he didn't have to be out on TV every week, but could cut the big promo. If it could build to one match occasionally, you could do that. But, of course, physically he was limited by that. But
and a dude that, you know, if you're working authority angles like that, he's going in there, like, he's a dude that, like, could have made, like, a Cena or a Rock, like, transcend. Like, the way he works, the way him and Flair sell in this match is just, you're seeing them both side by side in the tag match, where they're both doing that thing they do, just making, like, Ron Simmons is still so green, and they make him look so good. Also, can I also say, didn't see it as much in the other Flair match, where it's like, you know, one-on-one, it's very much a facsimile of their matches from Mid-South, like in, like, 84 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Butch Reed's punching in this. On a night where we're going to have to talk about Sid, maybe the worst pro wrestling striker ever, Flair, Arn, Simmons, Flair and Arn, great on the punching tip in this. Butch Reed, boxing. I believe his jab. I believe his right hook. And I believe the way Arn sells all of it.
And at the end, Arn hits the DDT to Reed, the spot
great
of the
looking
night.
DDT too.
Simmons makes the save, and an all four brawl to the floor, and this is where they are all counted out. This thing went about 18-20.
This, I mean, dude, anticlimactic doesn't even describe it. This match is getting hot as hell, and then it's just over. And the count out is so fast. They are out there for like 6 or 7 seconds. They kind of get like a little bit away from the ring, and then it's just over. There's no like heat on trying to get back in the ring. You know, Wyndham doesn't come in and clip them and stop them. And like, what? There's none of that.
He was in makeup.
He's in wardrobe and makeup, getting the bleach washed out of his hair for the fuckery that's going to ensue imminently on this show. But this match was so good, and then just gets aborted out of nowhere so quickly.
And yeah, that would continue, of course, with that Clash of the Champions, where it would be Ric Flair and Butch Reed just coming up a few weeks after that. But good tag match. I don't think it was at the level of the Steiners and Doom, but I mean, on a tag heavy show.
Steiners and the Nasty Boys, the best tag team on this card.
Of course. And then we go to our man.
Here we go. This is the promo I'm talking about.
Another inductee into
a Hall of Fame speech that I watched.
There you go. Stan Hansen.
It's the pumpkin promo. If you've seen it before, it's the pumpkin promo.
This was probably the first time, when I was a kid, my first WCW video I ever purchased was this show.
Oh, baby.
On VHS. And this is my introduction to Stan Hansen, was this show. This guy who just cut this awesome promo and then walloped Lex Luger and took the U.S. title.
So are you going to describe the promo? Are you going to do a Stan Hansen impression? Like, what? We can't just leave the people hanging.
We're going to talk about it. He's got the pumpkin on the Halloween theme set.
Like a hand-sized one, like one you'd fit in the palm of your hand. And he's talking to it almost like Hamlet holding the skull of Yorick.
And he says this pumpkin represents Lexi.
Little Lexi.
And spits tobacco juice onto the pumpkin and says that Luger makes him sick.
Lex Luger, in just a few seconds, you're going to have to deal with me once and for all. And this represents little old Lexi. You make me sick. You get ready for the bell and not be ready for the jack-o'-lantern and all these other things, because in just in a few seconds, I'm bringing that bell out there, and I'm going to take that title, and I'm going to take it all the way back to Texas.
The way this goes is, and this right here is little Lexi. You make me sick!
You can't adequately recap a Stan Hansen promo without channeling
To be clear, he spits the tobacco on the pumpkin as if it's Luger's face, and then turns the pumpkin around, dripping in tobacco.
It's coming out of his mouth. He's taking this title back to
Texas.
This
is also the best I think I've ever seen a big ol' and like a real chew. You know what I mean? This isn't like Skull Wintergreen. It's like you just puck it in there. This is real honest to God chew, and it's only about half done. So the amount, not only is it flying everywhere as he talks, the amount just hanging off his face is truly incredible.
The only thing that would have made this promo better was if he had an actual pumpkin that, as a callback to another famous Stan Hansen story, he ran it over with his truck, calling it Lexi, little Lexi.
Stan Hansen, what a legend.
Lex Luger and Stan Hansen for the United States Championship. This was prefaced by Jim Ross that this would not be pretty.
Nope. He says no go-behinds, no fireman carry takeovers and things like that.
I don't know why I enjoyed this exchange so much, but Heyman asks, do you want me to go get my notebook with a list of every neck that Stan Hansen has broken?
This
and
is a good line.
Jim Ross just immediately, only if your notebook is 30 or 40 miles away.
And I believe Heyman like actually concedes to the joke. And like, you know, it goes to show the chemistry that they kind of have on some level, because Heyman's like, oh, that's not very nice. I thought I was supposed to be the funny guy around here. Like, he clearly like gives Ross like the very subtle depth. By the way, I know he can't use the All Japan music, Sunrise or whatever that song's called. Sunrise by Spectrum. The WWE Network fill-in music that Hansen gets is atrocious. Can't they get some Tex Western kind of... God, it's awful.
He is out, and Heyman wants to tell the whole backstory of how Hansen broke San Martino's neck without saying his name.
Okay, is San Martino not working with them at this point? Like, he was there from, like, 90 to 92, like... He does like the hotline thing. I think on the Clash of the Champions, don't we make fun of the like Bruno Sammartino like pimping some hotline?
Oh, I'm trying to remember the exact timeline that he was.
It's like 90 to 92. He's just kind of there. He'd do like commentary on like weird smaller shows. Power Hour or whatever the hell. Like, San Martino's there, so I found it incredibly bizarre. Heyman brings it up 3 or 4 times, but just always stops short in that very pregnant pause.
Never says his name.
No, not once.
Hansen wears down Luger, and Heyman...
Can we talk about how Hansen, how much heat he gets on the match before there's anything even done?
Yeah.
Just runs around the outside of the ring, whips the cowbell at the floor, and like almost hits like a fan and a member of the crew, like tries to throw a chair in the ring. Like Hansen has this on fourth, fifth gear already before Luger's even about to start yelling like a moron in the ring.
Heyman says that next to Sid, of course, Luger is the most superbly conditioned athlete in the industry. So, whatever superbly conditioned means in 1990.
Yeah, so I was going to point that out. And also, I'd like to ask you, Johnny, if we go back in time, we're sitting there at the UIC Pavilion. And I tell you to look in that ring. And I tell you, man, you know, about 25 years from now, one of these dudes is going to weigh about 1/4 of this and be in a wheelchair. Who do you think it is?
Yeah, you'd have to lean Hansen.
And how does Stan Hansen look today, pal?
Stan Hansen's in great shape.
Looks fucking great for a man. Let's find out how actually old Stan Hansen is. Do you know off the top? Do you want to guess?
Stan Hansen, I'm going to guess off the top of my head, is early 60s.
John Stanley Hansen, 66 years old.
66.
Turning 67 on August 29th.
Younger than Vince McMahon.
Looks great for a dude that has just been beating the shit out of people and himself for... 40 years. 45 years, basically. Lex Luger, a dude that obviously took steroids, but by all accounts, a dude that, like, ate well until later, like, basically, you know, wasn't, like, in this era, like, a big, like, party dude, hardcore, like, painkiller abuser sort of dude. This isn't a
dude.
That
would come later.
Exactly. You know what I mean? And it comes as his body decays. But, like, it just goes to show, also it goes to show, just don't do steroids, kiddos.
This was also, I would say, the peak period of Lex Luger as a performer, as a draw, was 88 to 90.
Yep.
This was the tail end of it.
Yep.
I think that as well, I mean, he was kind of just lost. I think when Flair left the company, I think that was a major opponent that Luger loses, and he became that focal point.
This is already bad Luger, and I gotta give a shout out. We shouted out Bix earlier and whatnot, but... Gotta give a shout out to the Laps fan homies, Jack Cardassio and JP Sorrow. One thing, in addition to having the best impressions, you know, the best Vince, the best Jim Barnett, the best Johnny Ace, which he inadvertently debuted, the Cajun spinoff, Ole Anderson, a great Jim Herd impression, JP Sorrow is a star. But one thing that he pointed out in going through, you know, they did the whole WrestleMania journey, deep dive in talking to Meltzer on every WrestleMania, then just did it for Starrcade. Listen to these, going back and watching a lot of these events. JP pointed out, like, the best, it's the Lex Luger, are you interested, acid test. And it's so simple. And to my mind so far, I've not seen it thwarted or corrupted yet. You can tell pretty much, it's not necessarily a predictor of whether the match will be good. Because it's Luger.
Mm-hmm.
But you can tell how engaged, focused, and generally interested and passionate Lex Luger is by how he sells and what he does when he strikes. If Luger's taking chops and punches and doing the wow, oh, wow, you know that this dude does not give a fuck. And you can tell that he's already got his eye on the WBF. He's inside Vince's weird, warped, body dysmorphic mind. He knows that Vince wants him to be the narcissist. He's already getting the mind shapes. He does not want to be here, and especially not doing the job in his hometown.
That's right.
And also,
Chicago.
Johnny, we'll go over the end, and I think there's a huge blown opportunity here, but even though old Waylon Mercy, Mr. US Express 2, Danny Spivey makes a cameo here in a very interesting way that we'll talk about, the ending to this match is clean. No foreign object is used.
Oh, yeah.
Danny Spivey shows up, but essentially plays no tangible role in Stan Hansen winning the title. Luger loses clean in the city he's announced from and gets a hot pop when he's on the ramp and flexes it down.
Yeah, that to me was one of the most... When
Did
I watched
tell
this...
Jim Herd to, like, fuck himself? Or like, how is... Like, what is it? Like, oh, man, what a punishment.
Maybe he said, hey, Lex... Gary Strydom wouldn't put a fuss up in his hometown. Maybe, you know, if you want to be a top-level bodybuilder, you got to have the mindset.
Can I share a very funny and ironic thing with you in this match? And this is the kind of stuff all you wrestling nerds out here. This is why you want me doing this. They make a comment about Stan Hansen's tenure at West Texas State University. Obviously, one of the most famous wrestling institutions. Ted DiBiase and Tito Santana. There's like a million pro wrestlers. Terry Funk, all these dudes who played football there. Now, do you know what they say about Stan Hansen's collegiate football career?
Tell us.
They say that he was, it's not there, unless it's just under Hall of Fame. I tried Freebird Induction and Freebird's Hall of Fame, and I didn't get the intro, but you can keep looking. They say that Hansen's basically such a wild man, he was kicked out of West Texas State University, which one is not true, but two is bizarre and ironic because Lex Luger at the University of Miami famously was kicked off the team and transferred to Georgia Tech because he got irate about not starting a game and trashed a hotel room on the road. It's bizarre how they basically take a real story about Luger and graft it onto Stan Hansen's character. Even though, like, you know, because he's supposed to be the dastardly heel, like, what a crazy guy. Like, that's actually the story about the babyface getting kicked out of university football. Very bizarre and ironic sort of twist that I'm not even sure they're aware of. Like, I don't know if that's conscious.
And that would segue into a Montreal Alouettes tenure for one Lawrence Fall. That could have been the story, the rise and fall.
I was going to say, like, John, I mentioned your punting skills before. I hope we got me here.
It's like an empty net. You got to shoot. So Hansen misses in the corner, flies over the tops of the floor, as Ross says how Hansen and gives out the whole expulsion. And
Ross says he's
been expelled from wrestling in the U.S. many times. He's been blackballed. Man. Here he is back with the NWA.
I don't know if you have a comment on this, but I got to get it in just to make sure we don't miss it. Ross says, probably the craziest shit he says in the entire car. He says, Luger is the thinking man's wrestler, and then informs us that in college he had a 3.78 GPA.
Well, that would follow, too, during his babyface run in the WWF, where they would constantly hammer the fact, this guy went to school. He's intelligent. He's smart. It became part of the lexicon of Luger.
The lexicon.
I'm done. The Lex icon. Wow. Lex icon. There's the book title.
Lex Ico Pro.
There's a bulldog to Luger. Gets a
good,
two
good
count.
Bulldog by Hansen. Good job.
Yes. Misses an elbow off the second turnbuckle as Luger fires back.
Oh, by the way, when Luger kicks out of the bulldog, Hansen mutters, he's a professional, he knows he's on pay-per-view, you know, and also he works in Japan a lot, he knows kind of his manners, but very audibly mutters, when Luger kicks out, he kind of like shakes his head and just goes, fucking son of a bitch. Stan Hansen's the best.
So, as Hansen is getting set, wearing down Luger, he's setting up for the lariat, and then poor Mike Atkins gets knocked down.
How good is this spot? Like, obviously, this is preposterous because he should be disqualified, but the way it looks is so badass. This little referee tries to get in and get Stan Hansen off of Luger, and he just does like a back elbow right to the head intentionally without even looking at him. Like, dude, you're not even worth, I'm not even gonna make eye contact with you while I drop you nonchalantly with an elbow. It looks so awesome.
Plausible deniability.
Oh yeah, and dude, that's the other good thing. Like, oh, I didn't see you. Like, what? It's so good.
You're out of position.
Oh. My vision was impaired.
Luger takes Hansen down with a clothesline, and then we have Waylon Mercy, Dan Spivey make his way down.
Well,
to
we actually
inside.
Have Luger punching, and as he punches Hansen, going, wow, 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 which is how you know that Luger, he knows he's like 3 minutes away from the longest U.S. title reign in that belt ending, and he is not having it.
So Dan Spivey throws a cowbell to Hansen, who misses, and takes a back body drop and a face buster. And as Luger is calling for the torture rack, Luger then comes off the ropes and gets caught with a lariat. And the referee comes to, and Hansen pins him.
Clean.
And this crowd is stunned.
Yep, absolutely.
Like, the cowbell, really, it played no. It was not there to save Luger.
You'd think it'd be there to save his heat. Not a chance. And the crazy part is,
Ross has to play outraged.
And this is the best part, because you get another one of those situations. We're going to call them a Jesse situation, where the heel commentator refrains from becoming a caricature by using real knowledge. If anything, Heyman kind of blows it by stepping down as Ross gets apoplectic. Like, it's like he doesn't want to, like, step on him and kill the sort of face angle. But dangerously goes, like, Spivey didn't do anything. Like, he straight up tells Ross, like, he basically says, like, he beat him. I believe he says he beat him clean. He didn't hit him with a foreign object. And Ross just kind of has to be like, oh, like, but Danny Spivey, And Heyman kind of backs down, but he's right. And, like, that's what makes good commentary. You know what I mean? The heel commentator, especially if Ross is going to be indignant, the heel commentator, as, you know, as Jesse would, no one cheated. Dan Spivey came out, he played no material role in the outcome of the match. Also, very cool, because even though he doesn't get too deep into it, speaking of, you know, like the timeline where, you know, we're a few weeks ahead of the last show we did. Speaking of things that are going on, 3 weeks from now, these guys gonna go to All Japan for a little tour, get their heat with Terry Gordy and Steve Williams. Like, amidst this very time, they mentioned that, like, you know, Dan Spivey's his protege and they're wrestling in All Japan. But, like, they're amidst, I think the strongest, what do they call it? The strongest tag determination league? Is that the All Japan?
Yeah.
Tag team? Yeah. So, November 15th, so, like, just 2.5 weeks after this, that thing starts. And, Spivey and Hansen go to the finals for the vacant titles, actually, and, lose to the Miracle Violence Connection, and then win them, like, a few weeks later. Like, these dudes are All Japan tag champions. And also, Stan Hansen, getting paid.
How about this stat as well? Because earlier in this year was when the WWF and All Japan did that combined show.
Yep.
So you had Stan Hansen losing to Hogan on that show. And then here he is beating Luger like 6 months later.
Yeah. Gets the U.S. title here 6 months from now after losing to the Miracle Violence Connection in the Tag League tournament. Him and Spivey take the titles and transition them to a new brave era of All Japan Pro Wrestling, as it would be they would drop the titles as transitional champions to Mitsuhara Misawa and Toshiaki Kawada having the first title reigns together. Dan Spivey playing a surprisingly weird, you know, speaking of guys that, like, this is their peak, Butch Reed, this is Dan Spivey's peak right now. Like, Mark Calloway leaving, skyscrapers busting up, it really helps this guy out a lot because he's getting that All Japan tour. He's like, his run with Hansen is as successful as he would ever be as a wrestler. His best matches are clearly the Hansen tag matches against the Miracle Violence Connection. This is peak Danny Spivey. And by the way, peak Danny Spivey hair.
Oh, yeah.
The mullet is so long, so golden, and so spiky on top. It looks so good.
Shivani interviews Teddy Long, who's wearing this awesome Doom t-shirt from 1990.
Oh, by the way, real quick before we move on. When Hansen goes over, you mentioned the stun reaction. There's a dude, like, in the third row with glasses on who takes out a brick-sized tape recorder and is clearly doing a post-mortem and taking notes. I like to think that dude had notes for Big Dave. Like, Dave was, you know, even back in 1990, like, send us your Halloween Havoc reports. You know?
Wow.
HSMeltzer@juno.com.
The Juno email.
His dad's email.
Yes.
You told me that. I was dumbfounded.
So Shivani sets up the question by saying, you're still with the gold and that smirk on yo face.
Okay. I forgot about this. And when he said it, I was like, that's really strange. I was like, nah, whatever. It's, you know, I'm going to talk enough and cut John off enough. I don't need all these things. I'm happy that struck you as well.
Maybe some young tap-out entrepreneurs were thinking about a future URL address and thought, hey, there's something to that. Yo face. Where can we go with that?
American, arrogant, and in your face. It's Tony Schiavone.
Long says that homie don't play that, and that Doom is the meanest and baddest team in wrestling, and there are no more title shots for the Horsemen.
Wrong.
Enjoyed this from Mr. Teddy Long. Then Ross and Dangerously are with Missy Hyatt. And Hyatt predicts that Sid is going to win tonight, and it will be easy after what the Black Scorpion has, quote, done to his mind.
Missy's looking adorable here. Can we have, as we did on the last show, can we have our Missy Hyatt tribute moment? Oh, quick moment of reflection on, even if she's cut up her face and turned herself into a ghoulish figure, she's got a sense of humor about it. I saw her tweet recently, as I mentioned, her great Twitter on the last review away we did together. Saw a tweet she had recently that saying her great contribution. It was a picture of her from the 90s, and it was like, my first implants, no bra. looks terrible, but this is my great contribution to the industry. Breast implants. Love this woman.
Sid comes out in leather, in a leather vest and chaps.
Okay, so
the chaps would not be part of the WWF package.
No, but it is very much a prominent part of his look here, and I was wondering, like, I know Sid's from Arkansas, but he's not from, like, a ranch or something, is he? Like, why chaps? I just think that looked
Arkansas. That was Sid. Sting and Sid Vicious for the what was listed as the World Heavyweight Championship on the graphic.
And oh boy, buckle up.
Both turn to play to the crowd, and then Sid just attacks him from behind.
This is the best spot of the match.
It really was.
It literally is. Because one, it makes Sting look like a moron, and Sid, one thing that Sid can do well, he can clothesline things. I also saw that sign. I also saw that picture.
Damn.
It's like on a piece of cardboard.
It says, Sting will put the scorpion on Sid Vicious. Scorpion spelled S-C-O-R-P-I-A-N.
Scorpion. And again, this is a sign. It looks like it's written in blood on a piece of corrugated cardboard.
I love this crowd. They're my favorite. By the way, we have the Freebirds entrance queued up for
Thank God. You got it right in time for the main event.
Yes, we will watch this after the review. So, Sid runs him pose first on the floor, misses a shoulder block in the corner. Sting is then working the left arm, and
the worst arm wringer. The way they set it up, Sid misses. He falls to his knees and just. Like, he just looks like he's kneeling. There's no... Sid, the selling in this match is non-existent. No one sells anything, both in terms of making you believe they've been hurt, but also going back to the bewilderment angle, the code word, the nucleus of this show. Most of the time in this match, Sting and Sid just have these blank expressions on their faces.
So it continued, and
the arm wringer goes like 30 seconds, and Sid literally just lays down on his knees. He doesn't make a sound. He doesn't close his eyes. He doesn't grimace. It looks like he's like reading.
There was also, must have been a directive by Keith Mitchell to search for any fan in the crowd with Sting face paint on because they would get an ISO shot. They cut to just anyone, adults, kids. They found, I think, three of them. Sid did a fucking kip up.
Okay. Does he do a kip up to a clothesline? Is that what he does?
He did it out of the head scissors.
Yeah. It looks great.
Dangerously says how, because they're talking about the knee injury that Sting suffered back in February and came back from. And Dangerously just says, well, the hell? Sid came back from a punctured lung. That's way more impressive.
As we talked about, the reason that I chose Clash of the Champions Thanksgiving Thunder last time is that Sid, I believe, to be in the worst match I've ever seen with Brian Clark, the Night Stalker. And they're selling, as we talked about, overselling the punctured lung in that match. And we made the reference to, isn't it fitting for this abomination of a -5-star, like, anti-classic, that the injury they're trying to sell is the lung, which I believe, as you said, it's a hard target to isolate.
Sting reverses an Irish whip, then misses a Stinger splash, and then Sting turns back and turns around into a high cross, kicks out immediately.
I want to get to this because I actually think that the crossbody, that is so emblematic of this match. But a few quick things. They sell Sid's size the entire match and talk about how much bigger he is than Sting. Like, he's obviously thicker. He's not that much taller. It seems ridiculous when they bring it up over and over again. And there's a point where, going back to the face-painted kitties you mentioned, Heyman's bagging on Sting, and Ross gets really revved up and says, that's his motivation right there. Kids with their face painted.
That's what's motivating Steve Borden in 1990.
Kids who write and write back. He's an outstanding role model for any younger man watching this. Now, bearing that comment in mind from Jim Ross.
Was he an advocate for literacy too? Because he should be concerned.
This is how I feel. Is Steve Borden not the man in someone's autobiography, and I can't recall who, that one of the dudes talks to, it's Gary Hart. Maybe. Someone from like Mid-South, like when they met him like with Warrior or something like that. And in his book, he talks about how one of Sting's favorite things was making fun of retarded kids in the airports and mocking them openly.
I had not heard that story.
Someone out there, check me. This is definitely a thing. I can't think of who it was, but it's definitely someone that worked with Sting in Mid-South. And like talks about like, and also someone who like was with him in WCW, because I think they mentioned like being with him like during this era. And like basically it's one of those, you know, like lazy pro wrestler book things where it's just like, story about this guy, story about this guy. And he basically says, I wish I could remember who it was. Because he's like, yeah, I didn't really think much of the guy. He was an okay worker. He had some charisma, but he wasn't that good on the stick. And he liked to make fun of the cognitively disabled in airports to their face. The little stingers.
They fought on the ramp. Sid returns, and then Sting runs and leaps over the top and clotheslines Sid. That was maybe.
But by the way, when he does the springboard, it looks great, goes right down to the floor. He kicks at Nick Patrick.
Yeah.
Nick Patrick tries that. By the way, Nick Patrick, just the worst. He is unbelievable in the literal sense. Like, I have to think, looking back through so many Starcades now, and having seen as much WCW, I have to think the NWO Mark Ref is a rib on this dude actually being the worst.
Probably the most detrimental to a big match, where a referee has so fucked up such an important match.
Speaking of
Sting. Again, yeah. Nick Patrick just followed this guy. I wonder if Nick Patrick, to this day, if he ever gets angry and, like, goes to bang a table, that his arm doesn't, like, fucking jerk as he's making the count.
What better sums up Nick Patrick than, for any notable pro wrestling referee ever, he has the worst counting cadence in history.
It always bothers
me. The way he lays and just, like, it's like flops his arms back. He sucks, dude. He is awful.
Sting then hits a pescado to the floor, and this is when Ric Flair and Arn Anderson appear at ringside, and Sting chases Sid up the aisle. And then it is the fake Sting, Barry Windham, that returns with Sid. There is a scoop slam.
Describe what Barry Windham looks like here, John. Okay. Go deep. Describe what this man looks like.
Picture Steve Borden if he had like a... like a bicycle pump inserted into his back, and they just did about 20 pumps. And that was the fake Sting that returned here.
Also, he doesn't have the little rat tail at the end.
No.
He just has the bleach blonde. It's noticeably shorter. And this made me realize so profoundly that Lanza, Mulligan, you know, they may have looked similar, but there's no question which one had the stronger genes. Because, oh boy, just like Kendall and the rest of them, Barry is his father's son. The face, even in the Sting paint, is so clearly Barry Windham. It's so clearly him.
And as he comes back, he goes for a scoop slam, and Sid lands on top, and he pins him. And the fans are just stunned. I think more out of confusion than the result of, what the hell is going on here?
This dude, again, bewilderment. That's our word for this radio show.
I don't know how you could have pieced this together in the audience that night, with the benefit of commentary.
This is exactly what I was going to point out. At this point, by the way, kind of indictment of Sting, there is a lot of people who are fucking pumped that Sid goes over. There is an entire section on like the face in the hard camera side, first three rows, just people defiantly sticking the four up. It's like Sid is obviously not as over as Flair or Arn, but the mere association, the Horsemen are still so over that like huge swaths of this crowd are stoked that Sid's going over.
Yeah, it wasn't at the level of when he beat Shawn for the title in New York, but this was always, I mean, that Northeast, they would gravitate to Sid, and this was clearly evident here in this show in the Midwest, where Sid was like a cool heel at the time that they were getting into. And yeah, you got that kind of reaction, just a title change first of all, but
and just think, 3 weeks from now he's gonna have literally the worst pro wrestling match ever.
That's still to come. So the real Sting then returns, and he's got a rope tied around his wrist.
Are you going to gloss over when the ships pass in the night? Because the Stings meet up.
Yes, they have that moment where they see each other.
And literally, that is it. They see each other.
That's it.
Sting looks at Barry Windham, looks bewildered. He isn't mad. You know what I mean? He literally just has this blank, like again, it almost feels meta in that everyone is portraying on their face the idea of, like, where am I? What am I doing? What have I become? And then Barry Windham runs away like a small child.
All this work.
It is.
It paid off, and you're just going to let the guy come back and reclaim his title.
Like what? Like he's like bigger than Sting. He's there. He's a member of the Horsemen. And the way he runs away, he like crouches and scampers. This sucks. This is crazy.
Sting comes back in, and he gets a splash and an inside cradle to pin Sid.
Oh.
No bell re-rung.
Wait. You're letting Nick Patrick off the hook here. How does he set up the Stinger splash, Johnny?
Enlighten me. I didn't write down the details.
He hits Sid with the fucking belt right in front of Nick Patrick. He runs in the ring. Sid is still celebrating his alleged title win. He has the belt in his hands, the big gold belt. He swings it at Sting, and it's the worst. It's the plastic axe from the Night Stalker match all over again 3 weeks earlier. It's so slow. Sting ducks it, kicks him, takes the belt, and hits him square in the face. Nick Patrick stands there. Stinger splash. Terrible inside cradle because Sid's legs are so long and so weird. Like, his entire body is his legs, so Sting can barely hook them. 1, 2, 3, and the entire crowd, bewilderment. Some people celebrate, like people in Sting paint. Even the people who were sticking their fingers up in the Four Horsemen, they just look like, what? And everyone else is just stunned silence. Like, no one really cheers. There's some people clapping like, yeah, thing happened, Sting. But everyone just looks confused.
And you look at things, and granted, I mean, Sid was not going to be long for this company, but at this point in 1990, I mean, he's in the fold here, and I mean, doing this turn, I mean, that was something they never really did in the Horsemen, the idea of another guy wins the title, and suddenly Ric Flair is not the focal point.
Dude, that would have been hot as hell. And you could have done shit with Sid, because Flair could have carried his ass, in a great way, probably.
Like, realistically, you could have started teasing that. You'd have to wrap up this stupid Black Scorpion deal, which shouldn't have been Ric Flair. And
thanks, Al Perez.
And that's
job or not wanting to do a job when he gets the biggest opportunity of his life.
So they note that obviously was not Sting in the ring. And then Ross interviews Sting. They show the replay of the two Stings coming face-to-face, and they would never meet again until, I guess, the NWO with Jeff Farmer.
Oh, God.
And Sting says he will always be here to defend the title, Rossi. And Dangerously is just livid, as were most of the crowd at the UIC Pavilion, as Ross signs off and we go into the credit roll and the man responsible for that.
We also get that classic ending that you get on so many JCP and WCW shows in this era where Ross hurriedly, panically goes, "We got about 30 seconds left, fans!"
They're probably going to cut this off the VHS anyway.
I'm actually surprised how much they pack in after Ross says, "We got about 30 seconds left." There's some Starcade where it like ends like that. Like, Flair wins a title or something. They got to do this like super quick sign-off. But the moment I want to go to in this match to let you know just like how much this sucks even before the dumb gimmick is we mentioned that cross-body earlier. And the idea of winning titles in the NWA. Across not just this territory, across territories. High cross body, respected finish.
Yeah.
People won, like, multiple people won NWA titles like this. In the 60s, 70s, right into...
It's a great near fall spot, too, when the guy reversed
isn't
it.
Isn't that how Flair beats Race in 83?
Yep.
This is a finish that is well respected in this territory. Sting hits a beautiful one. He's a high flyer. He's your top babyface. He's your champ. He hits a beautiful one at an ascending, crescendoing piece of what's ultimately going to crash and burn in this match. And Sid kicks out at one. When you see that moment, after watching the worst fucking arm wringer that Sid literally just like goes into a fugue state in, the fact that no one sells anything in this match. When they go to the ramp twice, no, like Sid slamming them on the ramp, Borden's hopping up 2 seconds later. This is, like, again, it's like there's two people outside their bodies controlling them. They're going through what they know are the motions of a pro wrestling match, but it is neutered, it is weak, and it is made unsalvageable by the idea of it's Halloween. Stop me if I'm wrong. The only way that this finish, because this doesn't connect anything like you mentioned. The Black Scorpion feud is the thing that's ongoing. And until the NWO somehow, Barry Windham and Sting ain't going to cross paths. There's nothing being set up here.
Well, that was just the Sting and a fake Sting.
Yes.
I mean, there was really... This main event, this was like a pivot point.
Yeah.
Just from one to the next.
This is going nowhere fast. The only way...
Except in Ole's mind. Shouldn't have fired Ole. He had it all mapped out.
So, knowing that is the context and circumstance of this match, can we safely assume and surmise that the only reason this was booked this way, the only reason that Barry Windham gets a haircut, a bleached eye job, like this is real.
Think of the work that went into this fucking finish.
And full face paint, and another pair of Sting's tights, puts Sting's boots on. They go through this effort for what is a confusing, bewildering 90-second Halloween gag on the running theme of, hey, like, multiple fights on this, or fights, multiple matches on this card have been resolved as a result of costuming trickery. You know, the Nasties get their heat back on the Steiners because they dress up as popcorn vendors. The Southern Boys, you know, help the rock and roll, one half of the rock and roll, Ricky Morton and Tommy Rich, help them go over by dressing up like Cornette. There is a running theme of the costume as foreign object and reckoner in this card. Do you believe that's literally the only reason that it was booked this way? Like, it's Halloween. We should do it like a dress-up thing as a false finish.
I think this was one of those where it was just, how do we book ourselves out of this match? And you go so far down a rabbit hole that
literally anything would be better. Name an outcome, even if it somehow includes like horseman interference or some kind of silliness that would typify the era. Even if this match included that, name a more absurd finish. Because what is worse than abject confusion?
That's what the end result was.
8,000 people are standing there. Like, there's some people like, oh, like Sting won. But everyone else there is standing there like...
There was no announcement.
No.
Of these are the circumstances of why this is being restarted.
Nope.
There was nothing for this live crowd to take away other than what the
literally,
fuck?
Dude, okay, if you were watching live, the only thing you really get is when Sting runs back in after they basically said, you know, that's not Sting. Right after he hits Sid with the belt, directly in front of senior official head referee Nick Patrick, who for some reason doesn't hell, even if that was the finish, he gets disqualified by hitting him with the belt because he was so enraged that he was bamboozled. And Sid, like, gets this, like, slimy win on Halloween. I accept that more than this. At one point, Ross says, fans, this one ain't over. That is all you get. So going back to your point, if you were standing there in the UIC Pavilion, you would have no idea what the hell happened.
That wraps up Halloween Havoc, 1990. We're now going to get some feedback here, and there are some questions for Jordan as well.
Oh, God, really?
So I'm going to run through these quickly here. Mick Whalen writes, Halloween Havoc 1990 was an odd show. The first four matches of this card were all tag matches, which is just weird. That was, of course, the editing as well. In my opinion, the Midnight Express was the greatest tag team that never worked for the WWE, I guess save for the new Midnight Express in 98.
We already talked about the Miracle Violence Connection.
The Freebird Warriors match was not good, but the next two tag matches were very good, even though WCW screwed up again by giving the Nasty Boys a great showing against Steiners, only to allow them to jump to the WWF. I love Stan Hansen, but aside from Bruno, he never really had a great rival in North American wrestling, and he was just suited too well for Japanese wrestling to make it.
He had good matches with Backlund.
Yes, he did. He had a very good run there in the WWF. He goes 6.5 out of 10 for his review and says, Halloween Havoc is usually looked back on as one of WCW's lesser pay-per-views, but what were some of your favorite Halloween Havoc pay-per-views, Mr. Breen?
Well, my third appearance, third time's a charm.
Spin the wheel.
Spin the wheel, make the deal. We're getting a wheel. Let me quickly look up every Halloween Havoc just so I can go through. Obviously, there's some really bad Halloween Havocs because the Hogan Warrior is a fiasco.
Oh, 95, where the giant dies and is resurrected.
Okay, oh, shit. Okay, so let's go through every Halloween Havoc real super quick here. 89 is good, the initial one. The Thunderdome tag match is actually really, really good. Pillman carries really well. And also, the Doom, the good Doom, from a year earlier, beating the Steiners with the masks on and Woman. Really good stuff. So the first one, very good. 1990, we just talked about. 91, which you guys have already done, of course, is the Chamber of Horrors, which is an astonishingly bad match and fantastic. Honestly, 91 is up there for me because it is a train wreck of a show. Like, you lead with the Chamber of Horrors. You have all, like, you know, Steve Austin going to the time limit draw with Dustin Rhodes is weird. We get a Bill Kazmaier with his inflatable globe taking Kevin Nash out his Oz. The Patriots, Todd Champion, Firebreaker, Chip wrestling, Arn Anderson, Larry Zbyszko for the titles. And then, you know, the Luger, Ron Simmons thing. It's such a bizarre card that I got an affinity for it. 92, I mean, next time I'm here, I'm excited to talk about it because, you know.
We'll save that one.
Dude, I mean, it's spin the wheel, make the deal. It's a catastrophe, but you still get Vader. Also, 91, I believe, you got the Halloween Phantoms. Yeah, so you get Rude's debut, crushing Tom Zink. Good memories. 93, what do we got? Oh, 93 actually appears to be a good one. Because you got, like, the Nasty Boys winning the titles, obviously near and dear to my heart, and the Vader Cactus Jack match in the main event. Which is, so, 93, pretty... 93, like, I haven't watched it probably in years, but, like that Vader Cactus Jack, of Rude and Flair, too, although Rude's work at this point in time is, not so good. So, 93, definitely quality. 94 is where you're starting to get just... Dude, you got Dave Sullivan.
Flair's retirement.
Yeah, you got Dave Sullivan against Kevin Sullivan, you know, not a good look. 95, the monster truck sumo match. That's the sadness. I love it so much. This is the thing. The question was like, what's your favorite? But really, Halloween Havoc is so ridiculous that you pretty much just got to go like every year there's something. There's just something ridiculous about it.
98 turned into a disaster. 99 was the first Russo and Ferrara booked show. And then 2000 was the last one, which featured...
Okay. I'll end it with this. Ultimate Halloween Havoc moment. And arguably, the best match of the Bischoff
97?
Era. 97, Rey Mysterio.
Yes.
And Eddie Guerrero for... Is Cruiserweight title,
Cruiserweight
right?
title.
Yeah, Hair versus Mask. It's... In terms of, like, psychology and storytelling with just, like, purely the match, it's probably the best match in like, that entire era of WCW. Everything about it. It's like, there's, like, one or two spots that, like, they're so ambitious that they aren't perfect. But, oh, man, like, you can't watch that match and possibly not think that Eddie Guerrero is just legendary. Legendary. That's the peak of Halloween Havoc. 97, if you've never seen that match, you know, you can go through your combination. Like, I feel like most people kind of see that division as, like, the trinity of Malenko, Ultimo Dragon, and Rey changing, like, interchanging matches. But Eddie's feud with Rey is just... By the way, all the love for Big Dave, but historically, one of his grandest fuck-ups is only giving that match 4.5 stars. Easy 5.
John from Indianapolis. Jordan sure knows how to torture you, John, but to be honest, I love it when you guys do crappy WCW shows, and I really enjoyed the Clash of the Champions 13 review, so I'm looking forward to a 3-hour banter. This is a rather eccentric show from a content standpoint where you don't really have any high-profile matches, considering that the infamous Thunderdome cage match between Sting and Luger against Flair and Muda was the prior year's event and would have at least been an interesting centerpiece to discuss.
Think about how quickly, like going back to one of the things we talked off the top, you know, the fact that literally we took shows like measurable in days apart and we're losing Jim Cornette and Stan Lane. We're pushing the Nasty Boys towards the title.
Big transition period in the next
Imagine,
couple of weeks.
Where was it held in 89? Okay, it's the Philadelphia Civic Center.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine you're a hardcore Philly wrestling fan. The NWA, and dude, it's a WWE town. Always has been. Always. They come to town. You're going to get to see the NWA. You get to see the 89 one and see, you know, Doom go over the Steiner brothers, the best incarnation of Doom. You get to see, you know, the Flair and Sting over Muda and Funk match. Like, the Thunderdome match is awesome. You see that card and then think, man, that was hot. We're going to drive Chicago for 90. How steep is that departure from one Halloween to the next? What you're getting on 89 versus Barry fucking Windham as Sting for 90 seconds in an inexplicable Halloween rip.
Well, there's two outcomes to trick or treat. That's my best. Okay. There is a big question here about the Ariel Helwani situation, which we're not going to get into, as me and Jordan have probably discussed it significantly on our own shows, and I'm battling against the clock here as we wind things down. Vince from Vaughn. Jim Ross and Paul Lee were great on the show. I love the antagonism between those, and Bobby Eaton was great. Flair and Arn Anderson were amazing. They made Doom look incredible. The rest of the show was only salvaged by the commentary.
Agreed. Oh, I mean, I think there were some great points to the show. It was a good blend of surprisingly good and terrible. I was surprised how much I enjoyed certain parts of the show, but
there was some good stuff on
the
show.
Absolutely.
This was hardly some just, you know, camp WCW show or anything like that.
And if not for having to sell for the Black Scorpion and some of his other lunacy, like it ain't like JR, well, who knows what kind of input JR had, even though they started pushing him away at this point, but it ain't like Heyman and Ross booked this thing, you know? They just got headsets on and they gotta take a bite of the shit sandwich. And that said, especially in comparison to how they put up with it 3 weeks later or whatever, they're awesome.
Joe in Maryland. Hello to John and Jordan. Interesting pick this week. Some great wrestling minds on this show from Ross, Cornette, Heyman, etc. I always forget how unbelievably over the early 90s WCW core stars were, like Sting, Luger, Flair, Arn, and the Steiners. The Freebirds, albeit not the world-class rendition, still oozed charisma like nobody else in 1990. Scott Steiner, wait till you see them in 2016. Scott Steiner and Brian Knobbs did more damage to English grammar than to one another in the stiffest match on the card. Impressive, if you ask me. They should have been taking promo notes from Stan Hansen.
Oh, boy. I love that someone shouted out the pumpkin promo. Also on the stiffness tip, another Nasty Boys lovely note. When you watch this match or any Nasty Boys match, watch when they break up pins. Always dropping elbows right on the back of the dude's head. None of this, like, I always hate when someone runs in, like a dude has like a tight lateral press, and a dude like kicks him in the back, and he's like, ugh, lost my pin. This is bullshit. Hit him in the back of the head with an elbow.
It's when you see the Nasty Boys like really click, and it's a brawl, and this kind of a match, or it's the concession brawl as you mentioned. Like, there's no two better people at being the Nasty Boys than Brian Knobbs and Jerry Sags.
Like
there is, like, you do not want polished technicians that have to adapt to a brawl. You want these guys in that role, and you would see where they would shine.
Absolutely.
And it was in the NWA and WCW where they had their that latitude with a lot of their. Their programs that would have you never got that in the WWF. They didn't have that hallmark program in the WWF, in my opinion.
Hell, man, imagine they got like the NWA WCW run, but still got to work with the Hearts. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Would have been beautiful.
He says here that Scott Steiner and Brian. Oh, sorry, we covered that already. Not a bad show. Certainly outdated. I could have done without the overkill on Halloween costume spots and finishes. Unfortunately, I think the network version cut out a few matches, including one for the Master Blasters. And finally, Trent from Texas. Okay, this could be opening up a hornet's nest. Because it starts off by saying, I don't get the love for Bobby Eaton.
I feel where he's going, speaking ahead.
The guy had no charisma, mic skills, and had a horrible look. He was a nice hand in the ring, but nothing special. People act as if he should have been a world champion for some reason. I don't know how many people advocated for him to be a world champion. Once you remove Cornette and Stan Lane, the guy was just what he really is, a generic jobber.
That part's not true.
The guy was just like tuna. If you had a lot of... Okay, well, he's now just like laying it on here.
I like tuna. I'm a big tuna salad fan.
Well, a lot of people were Bobby Eaton fans.
Well, I mean, the fact is, and like you see it on this match...
He was left in no man's land with the loss of Lane and Cornette.
Oh, I mean, he's a dude that got saddled with terrible gimmicks and was just like the loyalist dude. I think part of it, obviously, there's industry love for him. Because he's a great company guy that
he was also one of the most popular guys amongst the locker room.
Well, that's what I'm saying is like, think about what this sport is like. How even like well-regarded, accomplished people are sniped at and the polarity and diversity of opinions about any topic, any person. And you don't hear anyone sewer Bobby Eaton. Ever. Ever. Like, he's just a dude that everyone liked. So when you combine that from the locker room with the fact that for this time, he is an astonishingly good worker. You know, like, I'm taking the snipes like, oh, kick punch, kick punch, kick punch. But it's like, you know, like, if you're watching...
With 1990 eyes watching him.
It's not like he's developing these moves at this point. He's doing this shit in 86.
Yep.
He's doing this when he's with Dennis Condrey. So, like, you know, when you're watching, like, you know, and, you know, 85, 86 midnights, even before Stan Lane gets there, and you're seeing them do the rocket launcher, and Bobby Eaton's throwing beautiful guillotine leg drops off the top rope, he freestyles a backbreaker in this match where he goes belly to back, pivots, slingshot, bounce the dude off the rope, deep backbreaker. Like, this dude just had so much, like, yes, he had a terrible look, but part of why we see Bobby Eaton as ridiculous now is that he kept the mullet so long, and he had a very 80s mullet. The fact that he just kind of was generic and doughy, you know, think about this. It's not, if you're coming at it from the perspective this dude could have been like Hogan or, you know, whatever, or could have even been like a babyface champ, you're probably thinking about it the wrong way. Consider what, in his time, in the 80s, even as singles guys, what people looked like in this territory. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Guys, you didn't necessarily had to have that look. You didn't have to look like Magnum T.A. to be over. You know, the fact that he's just a little bit puffy was really not a huge thing. I think we see him as more ridiculous now because of the combination of that and the hair that he kept forever. But if you were watching the Midnight's work in either incarnation in this time, the offense was just so far ahead. Like, you know, there were no British Bulldogs in JCP and in Mid-Atlantic and these kind of places. You know what I mean? They weren't going to Memphis and seeing people doing synchro flying headbutts and like double drop kicks off the top rope. Like, the fact that Eaton could work the way he did was, like, his offense, you even see some in this match, it's just so far ahead of what most people, especially in tag team wrestling, you were getting at the time.
Most people are listening to this on at least Wednesday, so this is not new news.
Oh, God.
Roman Reigns fails a wellness policy test. He states, I apologize to my family, friends, and fans for my mistake in violating WWE's wellness policy. No excuses. I own it. They did not list what he tested positive for, but, man, rare wellness policy suspension, and...
What was I just saying?
If not top guy.
What was I just saying about Hanson and Luger? Push the dudes on steroids.
Well, we don't know the substance, but nonetheless,
Roman Reigns. You think it was a diuretic?
You never know. Maybe.
He had to cut that weight.
Maybe wanted to ditch the vest. Wanted to cut some weight. So we're going to finish this off.
Speaking of seeing shocking things for the first time.
Yes. We'll also announce, Wei Ting will be back next week. We are going to review the 2002 King of the Ring, the Brock year.
Ooh.
So maybe Jordan will be listening to that. We will see. But as we end off the show, a rating out of 10 for Halloween Havoc.
Right. And I failed to do this last time. Okay.
I go seven.
Pardon?
I go seven on the edited version. Yeah. I got enjoyment out of this. There was some shit on this show. But this was an easy 2-hour watch for me.
I will score this. The good is really good, but there's really some festering here. Some particular grossness encroaching. So I will award Halloween Havoc 1990 7 partially moldy pumpkins.
There you have it. Jordan?
Seven pumpkins that have been spit on by Stan Hansen. Little Lexi.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap this up with us watching the Freebirds entrance at Hall of Fame.
Atlanta, GA.
I want to plug his stuff before we go. Of course, SureDog.com is where he can go. Does a ton of great radio shows, Cheap Seats, Press Row, Round Tables. He is the encyclopedic authority of mixed martial arts. But you say so myself. Are you going to Las Vegas, by the way?
I don't believe I am. I don't know, maybe we'll sneak on a plane late. We'll have some fun.
All right, well, maybe we'll smuggle Jordan to Vegas.
Ooh.
But here it is, the Freebirds.
Full screening, hit and play, here we go.
Yes, they got Lynyrd Skynyrd as well for...
Well, it's funny because, no, they didn't get Lynyrd Skynyrd because they're all dead from a plane crash a million years ago. There's literally one...
This is my highlight of the Hall of Fame. What's the entrance? Come on, this is great. Watch Jimmy Garvin. He's going to steal the show.
Oh, he's doing the fingers! He's doing the fingers!
Man works for an airline company. And he got to be Jimmy Garvin of 1986 here.
Man, if you're going to live out your glory days in like a weird nostalgic thing, like this is, I'm happy we did this. This is like a good way to bookend this because I made fun of Jimmy Garvin earlier.
Come on.
And
look at these guys. They're having so much fun.
Triple H is sitting there. They show Triple H, he's clapping along and smiling, but he's really just thinking like, yeah, but they're no Harley races. Bradshaw gets up, cuts Hayes' hair off again. Is that coming? Oh, God. Jimmy Garvin's still giving it.
And blown up after this, both of them.
Of course.
But hey, it was worth it for this entrance. Jordan, a pleasure as always joining us here for Review Away.
I feel like, John, we might be the number one rock band in the world.
We can only hope. Jordan, if you and I can pull this off in 40 years from now, I mean, that's a win.
I'm excited to see you in this white vinyl duster that Michael Hayes is wearing, doing the rotating fingers at me.
I can never get my hair to Michael Hayes level. Never. All right, folks, that's going to wrap up the show. The Freebirds take us out.